Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I think when the first time I saw you was when was in Ian Walker's documentary film, I Psychopath. And you were at the very beginning of the film and you were saying that people, when they think of a narcissist or a psychopath specifically, that they think of like a Hannibal Lecter, somebody that's going to go out and kill all these people. And you said that that's not really accurate. It would be more accurate to think of poison as opposed to a knife. Most of the people that are narcissists, psychopaths, it's not like they're going to go around and kill a bunch of people. They would just be the folks who are going to bully and mistreat you on the job or bully and mistreat their family members, which seems much more in line with what you just laid out about that need for people. But them being there to be mistreated, to get approval from, to be exploited, this contradiction that you kind of laid out, can you touch on that a little bit?
Yes. The exact quote is a slow-acting poison. Mm-hmm. I compared psychopaths and narcissists to a slow-acting poison. It's not a poison whose manifestations are immediate and clear, and therefore it's not a poison amenable to treatment or to intervention. It is pernicious. It is insidious. It is all-pervasive. It permeates every cell of every relationship and every cell of every society and every culture by stealth, if you wish. It's often behind the scenes. It's often couched in passive-aggressive terms, like, and it's often camouflaged by all kinds of propaganda or righteousness or false modesty. So it's very difficult to discern. It's very difficult to diagnose. And consequently, it's very difficult to confront and to eliminate. Psychopaths and narcissists are snakes in the grass, but they don't appear to be snakes under inspection. They appear to be like you and me. Well, like you. They appear to be like normal people. I'm a narcissist, so it's not a good comparison. But they appear to be like normal people. They have families, they run businesses, they are pillars of the community, they function well in church and outside church, they are engaged in activities of various kinds. They are in the PTA. You know, they're not. There's nothing there that you can point at and say, "Ah, well, that's a psychopath. That's a narcissist." And this is precisely the danger. Narcissists and psychopaths are the closest thing we have on this planet to extraterrestrial aliens. They have no empathy, which is the core of what it means to be human. It is not possible to be fully human or even partly human without having empathy. And narcissists and psychopaths don't have that. They lack empathy. Not only do they lack empathy, but they have other traits and behaviors which render them alien to the human experience. They are a combination, a hybrid of artificial intelligence on the one hand and an alien life form on the other. But exactly like in the horror movies, they wear human flesh and blood. They disguise themselves within human bodies. Yet they do not think like you. They do not function like you. They are not motivated by the same things that motivate you. Their agendas are so outlandish that they are not even able to communicate with you effectively. They are a breed unto their own. They are a subspecies or a whole different species. That's how decisive the separation between psychopaths and narcissists and normal human beings, normal people, normal folk, that's how decisive it is.
If I could hop in really quick, I do see folks with questions, I want to get them too, but if I was going to play your adversary for a second and say, well, now wait a minute, Sam, you're talking about these folks as though they're aliens, as though we're talking about E.T. or something from a sci-fi film. You are describing yourself in this group as a narcissist, psychopath. You have been married twice. Is that accurate?
Yeah, true.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you rescheduled with us. You're doing this interview. You've done hundreds of interviews, and I've seen you talking with other folks and for an hour or hours talking with the same people, and everything was laughs and jokes, and, you know, you all got along great. How is it that you would say that you yourself, since you're in this group that you're saying is a total subspecies, lacking empathy, not even fully human because of your inability to relate with human beings, full human beings who have empathy for others. How would you explain that with yourself with regards to that lack of empathy and other ways that you're just not able to relate to other human beings?
I lack the basic operating system. Empathy is the operating system of the human mind. In its absence, the human experience, what it means to be human, is alien to me and to my ilk, to narcissists and psychopaths. It's not that we are not flesh and blood. Of course we are flesh and blood. And it's not that we are not of this planet. Of course we are of this planet. But we lack the basic module of what it means to be a human being. And it's not only empathy. It's our addiction. Our addiction is so overpowering that it transforms us and transmogrifies us and renders us to some extent monstrous. So if you combine all the traits and behaviors of a narcissist, the list is such that you would feel that the description does not fit a full-fledged human being. Now, you've described some artificial facets of my conduct. You said that I joke around and that I'm married. These are all operational specifications. I know how to imitate emotions. I have emotional resonance tables. So I have observed you and your kind, and I know which words go with which facial expression and which facial expression precedes which reaction. So I can predict your behavior, and I can modify my behavior to fit yours. This is called in computer heuristics. So I'm a heuristic programmed machine, kind of computer. But I also know to imitate empathy because I have a kernel of empathy, which is called empathy. I have a kind of X-ray vision. My ability to read other people, their body language, their needs, their priorities, their wishes, and most importantly, their fears, their vulnerabilities, the chinks in their armor. My ability to read all these is not complemented with, is not attended to any emotional response. I have no emotional response in gathering this data. While the vast majority of normal people, when they get to know you, when they gather this data, they have a set of emotional responses which go with the data that they have gathered. I do not. I collect information exactly as my laptop does. I classify it, I archive it for future use. And what do I need it for? I need it in order to manipulate you. And to manipulate you to what aim? To provide me with narcissistic supply. I'm an extraction device. I extract narcissistic supply, including in this interview or conversation between us. Now, I will do whatever it takes to extract from you narcissistic supply. And if what it takes is to empathize with you or to pretend to be empathizing with you, I would use my cold empathy to do that. And if what it takes is to commiserate or sympathize or make the correct noises, I will. But do not confuse this with the real thing. It's the outcome and byproduct of programming, self-programming. I have learned to observe and imitate.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, December 8th, 2017. So I have been told. I have learned to observe and imitate. Said Dr. Sam Vaknin, that is an admitted psychopath, narcissist, suspected racist. He was a guest on the program back in 2013. He has written about psychopathy. He's actually featured in the documentary film I, Psychopath. It's available online. I think Emmy mentioned him before. In fact, if you go back and listen to the archives from 2013, Mr. Demery Four called in and asked a few questions of Mr. Dr. Sam Vaknin, even though we were not able to locate his credentials to verify that he is a doctor. At any rate, I think he made a lot of significant points about the failure to or inability with regards to psychopaths' inability to empathize with other human beings. In fact, saying that that failure to empathize disqualifies psychopaths from being humans. You can certainly think about that in the context of white psychopathy as it relates to non-white people, especially black people. Great way to begin. Again, this is our book study session on Kevin Dutton's The Wisdom of Psychopaths. This is our fourth study session. We're picking up on chapter four. Hot Reading is the subtitle in chapter four. We're about halfway in the fourth chapter, Hot Reading, again, where we're picking up at. We will go ahead and get started. Again, context of white supremacy. This is Mr. Kevin Dutton's book, The Wisdom of Psychopaths, audio segment number one.
Hot Reading. The psychopath's fearlessness and focus has traditionally been attributed to deficits in emotional processing, more specifically to amygdala dysfunction. Until recently, this has led researchers to believe that in addition to not doing fear, they don't do empathy either. But a 2008 study by Shirley Fechteau and her colleagues at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston has thrown a completely different light on the matter, suggesting that psychopaths not only have the capacity to recognize emotions, they are in fact actually better at it than we are. Fechteau and her co-workers used TMS to stimulate the somatosensory cortex, the part of the brain that processes and regulates physical sensations, in the brains of volunteers scoring high on the PPI. Previous research has shown that observing something painful happening to someone else results in a temporary slowdown in neural excitation in response to TMS, in the area of the somatosensory cortex corresponding to the region afflicted by the pain. The work of highly specialized and aptly named brain structures called mirror neurons. If psychopaths lack the ability to empathize, Fechteau surmised, then such attenuation in neural response should be reduced in those individuals scoring high on the PPI compared to those with low to average scores, in exactly the same way that psychopaths might well, in comparison with most normal members of the population, display reduced yawn contagion. The researchers, however, were in for quite a surprise. Much to their amazement, Fechteau and her team actually turned up the opposite of what they were expecting. High PPI scorers, specifically those who scored high on the cold-heartedness subscale of the questionnaire, the subscale that most directly taps into empathy, in fact showed greater attenuation of the TMS response than low scorers, suggesting that psychopaths, rather than having an impairment in recognizing the emotions of others, indeed have a talent for it, and that the problem lies not in emotional recognition per se, but in the dissociation between its sensory and affective components, in the disconnect between knowing what an emotion is and feeling what it's like. Psychologist Abigail Baird has discovered something similar. In an emotional recognition task using fMRI, she found that while volunteers scoring high on the PPI showed reduced amygdala activity compared to low scorers when matching faces with similar emotional expressions, consonant with a deficit in emotional processing, they also displayed increased activity in both the visual and dorsolateral prefrontal cortices, indicative, as Baird and her team point out, of high-scoring participants relying on regions associated with perception and cognition to do the emotion recognition task. One psychopath I spoke to put it like this. "Even the colorblind," he said, "know when to stop at a traffic light. You'd be surprised. I've got hidden shallows." Or as Homer Simpson reminded us earlier, not caring and not understanding are two different things entirely. Of course, psychopaths' enhanced ability to recognize emotion in others might go some way toward explaining their superior persuasion and manipulation skills, as, needless to say, does their enhanced ability to fake emotion, a phenomenon we touched upon earlier in the chapter. But the capacity to decouple cold sensory empathy from hot emotional empathy has other advantages too, most notably in arenas where a degree of effective detachment must be preserved between practitioner and practice, in the medical profession, for instance. Here's one of the UK's top neurosurgeons on how it feels prior to going into the theater. Do I get nervous before a big operation? No, I wouldn't say so. But I guess it's like any performance. You have to get yourself psyched up, and you need to remain concentrated and focused on the job at hand, not get distracted. You have to get it right. You know, you mentioned special forces a few moments ago. And actually, the mentality of a surgeon and, say, an elite soldier about to storm a building or an airliner is possibly quite similar. In both cases, the job is referred to as an operation. In both cases, you tool up and don a mask. And in both cases, all the years of practice and training can never fully prepare you for that element of uncertainty as you make the first incision, that exhilarating split second of explosive entry when you fold back the skin and suddenly realize you're in. What's the difference between a millimeter's margin of error when it comes to taking a headshot and a millimeter's margin of error when it comes to navigating your way between two crucial blood vessels? In both of those cases, you hold life and death in your hands, must make a death or glory decision, in surgery, quite literally, on a knife edge. This guy scored well above average on the PPI. And if that surprises you, coming from one of the world's top neurosurgeons, then think again. Yawei Cheng at the National Yangming University and her co-workers took a group of medical doctors with at least 2 years of practice in acupuncture and a group of non-medical professionals and, using fMRI, peered into their brains to see what happened as they viewed needles being inserted into mouths, hands, and feet. What they observed was rather interesting. When the control volunteers watched the videos of the needles being inserted, those areas of their somatosensory cortices corresponding to the relevant body regions lit up like Christmas trees, as did other brain areas such as the periaqueductal gray, the coordinator of the panic response, and the anterior cingulate cortex, which codes for error, anomaly, and pain processing. In contrast, there was barely a flicker of pain-related activity in the brains of the experts. Instead, they exhibited increased activation of the medial and superior prefrontal cortices, as well as of the temporoparietal junction, brain regions involved in emotion regulation and theory of mind. Moreover, the experts rated the acupuncture displays as significantly less unpleasant than the controls did, reminiscent of numerous laboratory findings showing attenuated physiological responses, e.g. heart rate, galvanic skin response, or GSR, and cortisol levels, in psychopaths on presentation of fearful, disgusting, or erotic stimuli, and in the face of arduous social stress tests such as the TRIER. What the expert acquires through experience, psychopaths have from the start. Psychopath light? Not long after I came across Yawei Cheng's study, I hopped on a plane to Washington, D.C. and went to the National Institute of Mental Health to see James Blair. Blair is one of the world's leading experts on psychopaths and, like Joe Newman, has pretty much seen it all. Does it pay to be a psychopath? I asked him. Okay, not all the time, perhaps, but sometimes when the situation demands it. Blair was cautious. It's a dangerous road to go down. It's true that if bad things are happening, the individual with psychopathy might be less worried about it, he told me. However, it's not so clear that their decision-making in such situations would be particularly good, though. Moreover, by not analyzing levels of threat appropriately, they might walk into danger rather than away from it. In other words, if we could somehow defrost the reasoning a bit, take some of the chill out of the logic, then yes, psychopathic traits may well confer advantages. Otherwise, forget it. But wait a minute, I thought. Isn't this precisely what we find in the heroes of this world? No one would accuse them of poor decision-making. And what about the performance of Bekara, Shiv, and Lowenstein's functional psychopaths? And Fridman's hotshot hustlers? Okay, carrying the MAOA polymorphism that codes for risk and aggression doesn't automatically qualify you as a psychopath, but the link is certainly there. The way things turned out, their decision-making, under the circumstances, would more likely than not have been better than yours or mine. So maybe that was it. Maybe the equation just needed a bit of loss adjusting. Functional psychopath equals psychopath minus poor decision-making. By way of a second opinion, I caught up with the psychopath hunter Kent Keel. Keel is associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of New Mexico and director of Mobile Imaging Core and Clinical Cognitive Neuroscience at the Mind Research Network in Albuquerque. As his job titles suggest, he had a lot going on when I met him. In actual fact, Keel was on a road trip when we hooked up, and still is. Not your average kind of road trip. One involving an 18-wheeler truck, a vehicle so large that every time he parks it, I'm amazed he doesn't need planning permission. He certainly needs scanning permission, because inside it is a custom-built fMRI machine worth $2 million. And Keel is carting it around New Mexico, around a number of the state penitentiaries, in an attempt to unravel the neural basis of psychopathy. I asked him the same question I asked James Blair. Does it pay, at times, to be a psychopath? Keel, like Blair, was circumspect. It certainly makes sense that psychopathic traits are normally distributed across the general population, he told me. But the difference with those at the high end of the spectrum is that they can't switch off the fearlessness in situations where it might be appropriate. A CEO might be non-risk-averse in certain areas of business, but, on the other hand, probably wouldn't want to walk around a rough neighborhood at night. A psychopath isn't able to make that distinction. With a psychopath, it's all or nothing, which adds a third factor to our equation. Functional psychopath equals, open parentheses, psychopath minus poor decision-making, close parentheses, context. Which means, minus the algebra, that functional psychopathy is context-dependent. In the language of personality theory, it is state as opposed to trait, and in the right set of circumstances can enhance rather than encumber the speed and quality of decision-making. Back in the 1980s, the sociologist John Ray reached a similar conclusion. Ray postulated an inverted U-shaped function as the model most befitting the relationship between psychopathy and life success. In his own words, both extremely high and extremely low levels of psychopathy may be maladaptive, with intermediate levels being most adaptive. The basis for saying that high levels of psychopathy are maladaptive is, of course, the trouble into which clinical psychopaths often get themselves. The basis for saying that low levels of psychopathy may also be maladaptive stems from the common observation of the role of anxiety in psychopathy. Psychopaths do not seem to show any anxiety. The debilitating function of high levels of anxiety hardly needs to be stressed. In a normal, non-institutionalized population, therefore, their relative immunity from anxiety may give psychopaths an advantage. Ironically, this is precisely what Ayal Aharoni found within the criminal fraternity. It was neither high nor low levels of psychopathy that coded for criminal success. It was moderate levels, something that hasn't escaped the attentions of Bob Hare and Paul Babiak, as they continue their research into the area of corporate psychopathy. Hare and Babiak have developed an instrument called the Business Scan, B-Scan for short, a self-report questionnaire consisting of four subscales: personal style, emotional style, organizational effectiveness, and social responsibility, specifically calibrated to assess the presence of psychopathic traits, not within forensic populations like the PCLR, or within the general population, like the PPI, but exclusively in corporate settings. Within such settings, core psychopathic traits can sometimes morph into the star qualities characteristic of an influential leader, and in order to assess the presence of such traits with due sensitivity to context, it became imperative to ask the right questions, employing, of course, the right phraseology and language. The aim of the B-Scan is to do just that, by framing items within a corporate framework and by couching them in everyday business terminology, e.g., it's okay to lie in order to clinch the deal, agree/disagree on a scale of 1 to 4. At present, we're in the process of rolling it out to an independent sample of lawyers, traders, and special forces soldiers in the UK to see precisely what they're made of, a kind of psychological biopsy of various high-octane professionals. In a cafe in upstate New York, just down the road from Babiak's leadership and management consultancy company, I recount a conversation I once had with a top British Queen's Counsel at his chambers in central London. "In the courtroom, I have literally rubbed people out," the guy told me, "crucified them in the witness box. I have absolutely no problem at all reducing an alleged rape victim to tears on the stand. You know why? Because that's my job. That's what my client pays me to do. At the end of the day, I can hang up my wig and gown, go out to a restaurant with my wife, and not give a damn, even though I know that what happened earlier might possibly have ruined her life. On the other hand, however, if my wife buys a dress from a department store, say, and has lost the receipt and asks me to take it back, that's a different story altogether. I hate doing stuff like that. I'm hopeless, a real wuss." Babiak nods. He knows exactly what I'm getting at. It's exactly the same thing that the B-scan's designed to get at. We sip our lattes and stare into the Hudson River. Above the ice-gray water, vast continents of cloud press slowly and remorselessly across a low, tectonic sky. "What do you reckon?" I ask him. "Do you think we'll find an optimum score on the B-scan? A golden number that correlates with peak performance?" He shrugs. "We might," he says. "But my guess is it will probably be more like a range, and it may vary slightly depending on profession." I agree. I can't help thinking of Johnny and where he might fall on the scale. James Bond was licensed to kill, but he didn't kill indiscriminately. He killed when he had to, and didn't bat an eye. Mad, bad, or super sane? To wrap things up, I run my theory of functional psychopathy past a friend of mine. Tom is a member of the British Special Forces and has worked undercover in some of the hottest, most remote, and most dangerous places on Earth. He loves every minute of it. I tell him about the gambling games, the emotional recognition tasks, Ahmed Karim's transcranial magnetic lie enhancer, and the acupuncturists. Then I tell him about what James Blair, Kent Keel, Bob Hare, Paul Babiak, and Peter Jonasson have all said. "What exactly are you getting at?" he asks me, when I finally put it to him that donning night vision goggles and knife-fighting the Taliban in deep, dark cave complexes in the mountains of northern Afghanistan might not be every soldier's cup of tea. That I'm mad? That I'm some kind of loon who dares to rush in where angels fear to tread and gets off on it? Gets paid for it? Once I'm out of the headlock, Tom tells me a story. One night, a few years ago, he's heading back to his apartment after watching Saw. Suddenly, out of a doorway, a guy with a blade appears. His girlfriend is terrified and starts hyperventilating. But Tom, calmly disarms the guy and sends him packing. "Funny thing was," Tom says, "I actually thought the movie was quite scary. But then, you know, when I suddenly found myself in a real-life situation, I just kind of switched on. There was nothing to it. No nerves, no drama, just nothing." The neurosurgeon we heard from earlier agrees. Bach's St. Matthew Passion regularly moves him to tears. When it comes to football and the team he supported since he was a kid, sometimes he just can't look. "Psychopath?" he says. "I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure what my patients would think about it either. But it's a good word. And yes, when you're scrubbing up before a difficult operation, it's true. A chill does go through the veins. The only way I can describe it is to compare it to intoxication. Only it's an intoxication that sharpens rather than dulls the senses. An altered state of consciousness that feeds on precision and clarity rather than fuzziness and incoherence. Perhaps super sane would be a better way of describing it. Less sinister, more, I don't know, spiritual." He laughs. Then again, maybe that sounds even crazier. Chapter 5. Make Me a Psychopath. The great epics of our lives are the occasions when we gain the courage to rebaptize our evil qualities as our best qualities. Friedrich Nietzsche. The times, they are a-changin'. When you've been at the top of your game as long as Bob Hare has, you're entitled to be a little bit choosy about who you hang out with at conferences. So when it came around to the Society for the Scientific Study of Psychopathy's biennial bash in Montreal in 2011, and emailing the distinguished professor to fix up a meeting, I felt it best to keep things formal. Were a time window to present itself during the course of the proceedings, how about a coffee, I intimated. The response was instantaneous. I prefer fine scotch to coffee, Hare shot back. You'll find me in the hotel bar. I'll buy. He was right on all three counts. I decide to start off cautiously. So what the hell do you score on the PCLR then, Bob? I ask, over a 20-year-old single malt. He laughs. Oh, very low, he says. Around one or two. My students tell me that I really should work on it a bit more. But I did do something psychopathic not so long ago. I splashed out on a brand new sports car, a BMW. Great, I say. Maybe your students have more of an effect on you than you realize. My second question is more serious. When you look around at modern-day society, do you think, in general, that we're becoming more psychopathic? This time he takes a bit longer to answer. I think, in general, yes, society is becoming more psychopathic, he says. I mean, there's stuff going on nowadays that we wouldn't have seen 20, even 10 years ago. Kids are becoming anesthetized to normal sexual behavior by early exposure to pornography on the internet. Rent-a-friend sites are getting more popular on the web because folks are either too busy or too techie to make real ones. And I read a report the other day that linked a significant rise in the number of all-female gangs to the increasingly violent nature of modern video game culture. In fact, I think if you're looking for evidence that society is becoming more psychopathic, the recent hike in female criminality is particularly revealing. And don't even get me started on Wall Street. Hare's position makes a great deal of sense to anyone who takes even a passing interest in what they read in the newspapers, seen on TV, or stumble upon online. In Japan in 2011, a 17-year-old boy parted with one of his own kidneys so he could go out and buy an iPad. In China, following an incident in which a 2-year-old baby was left stranded in the middle of a marketplace and run over, not once but twice, as passers-by went casually about their business, an appalled electorate has petitioned the government to pass a Good Samaritan law to prevent such a thing from ever happening again. On the other hand, however, bad things have always happened in society, and no doubt always will. Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker has recently flagged this in his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. In fact, he goes one step further. Far from being on the increase, Pinker argues, violence is actually in decline. The reason that vicious slayings and other horrific crimes make the front pages of our papers isn't because they're commonplace, but rather the complete reverse. Take homicide, for instance. Trawling through the court records of a number of European countries, scholars have computed that rates have fallen dramatically down the years. In 14th century Oxford, for example, it seemed relative to today that everyone was at it, the rate back then being 110 murders per 100,000 people per year, compared to just one murder per 100,000 people in mid-20th century London. Similar patterns have been documented in Italy, Germany, Switzerland, the Netherlands, and Scandinavia. The same goes for war. Pinker calculates that even in the conflict-ravaged 20th century, around 40 million people died on the battlefield out of the approximately 6 billion who lived, which equates to a figure of just 0.7%. Incorporate into that estimate the war-related demise of those who died from disease, famine, and genocide, and the death toll rises to 180 million. That sounds like a lot, but statistically speaking, it's still pretty insignificant, weighing in, give or take, at a modest 3%. Contrast this with the corresponding figure for prehistoric societies, a whopping 15%, and you begin to get the picture. The beat-up Neanderthal skull that Christoph Zollicoffer and his colleagues dug up in southwest France, if you recall, is just the tip of the iceberg. The questions, of course, that immediately spring to mind when one is confronted by such figures are twofold. Firstly, do they fit with the idea that society is becoming more, and not less, psychopathic? Secondly, if less, what has happened in the intervening years to still so dramatically our murderous, violent impulses? Taking the latter question first, the obvious answer, or at least the one that probably tumbles most readily out of the majority of people's explanation closets, is law. In 1651, in Leviathan, it was Thomas Hobbes who first advanced the contention that without top-down state controls, we'd turn, rather effortlessly, into a bunch of brutish savages. There's more than a grain of truth in such a notion, but Pinker argues from a more bottom-up perspective, and while certainly not denying the importance of legal restraints, also insinuates a gradual process of culture and psychological maturation. Beginning in the 11th or 12th century, and maturing in the 17th and 18th, Europeans increasingly inhibited their impulses, anticipated the long-term consequences of their actions, and took other people's thoughts and feelings into consideration, he points out. A culture of honor, the readiness to take revenge, gave way to a culture of dignity, the readiness to control one's emotions. These ideals originated in explicit instructions that cultural arbiters gave to aristocrats and noblemen, allowing them to differentiate themselves from the villains and boors. But they were then absorbed into the socialization of younger and younger children until they became second nature. The standards also trickled down from the upper classes to the bourgeoisie that strove to emulate them, and from them to the lower classes, eventually becoming a part of the culture as a whole. From both an historic and a sociological perspective, this makes perfect sense. Yet concealed within Pinker's observations are a couple of critical precepts with more immediate implications, subtle sociobiological clues that, if examined in greater detail, may help square the circle of an interesting cultural paradox and go some way to answering the first of our two questions, the perception of a society on the one hand becoming increasingly less violent and a society on the other hand becoming apparently more psychopathic. Consider, for example, in Pinker's elegant exposition, the importance of the cultural arbiter as a conduit of ideological change. Traditionally, in days gone by, such arbiters would typically have been clergymen, or philosophers, or poets, or even, in some cases, monarchs. Today, however, with society becoming ever more secularized, and with the exponential expansion of an infinitely virtual universe, they're a different breed entirely. Pop stars and actors and media and video game moguls who, rather than disseminating the dictates of dignity, now offer them up on an altar of creative psychopathy. You've just got to turn on the television. On NBC's Fear Factor, we see grossed-out contestants devouring worms and insects. On The Apprentice, we hear the casual admonition, "You're fired." Simon Cowell wasn't exactly known for his eggshell-walking abilities, was he? And I shudder to think what's happening in Anne Robinson's pants as she fixes a losing player in her prurient, surgically enhanced gaze and announces, like some demented dominatrix diva, "You are the weakest link. Goodbye." But the cultural transmission of normative strains of behavior constitutes just one side of Pinker's sociobiological equation. Their absorption into society as conventional codes of conduct, until such time as they become second nature, is another matter entirely. Take the finance industry, for instance. Greed and corruption have always encroached upon the fringes of big business, from Civil War profiteers in the U.S. to the insider trading scandals that simmered beneath the surface of capitalist Thatcherite Britain back in the 1980s. Yet the new millennium has seemingly ushered in a wave of corporate criminality like no other. Investment scams, conflicts of interest, lapses of judgment, and those evergreen entrepreneurial party tricks of good old fraud and embezzlement are now utterly unprecedented, both in scope and in fiscal magnitude. Corporate governance analysts cite a confluence of reasons for today's sullied business climate. Avarice, of course, the backbone of Gordon Geckoism, is one of them. But also in the mix is so-called guerrilla accounting. As Wall Street and the London Stock Exchange expected continued gains, and the speed and complexity of business increased exponentially, rule-bending and obfuscation suddenly became de rigueur. With infinitely more complex securities, accounting practices, and business transactions, observes Seth Taub, a senior commercial litigation lawyer, it's much easier to hide fraud. Clive R. Boddy, a former professor at the Nottingham Business School, comes right out and says it, and in a recent issue of the Journal of Business Ethics, contends that it's psychopaths, pure and simple, that are at the root of all the trouble. Psychopaths, Boddy explicates, in language somewhat reminiscent of that used by Bob Hare and Paul Babiak in the previous chapter, take advantage of the relatively chaotic nature of the modern corporation, including rapid change, constant renewal, and the high turnover of key personnel, circumstances that not only permit them to wend their way through a combination of extroverted personal charisma and charm to the corner offices of major financial institutions, but that also render their behavior invisible, and even worse, make them appear normal and even to be ideal leaders. Of course, once in situ, such corporate Attilas are then, according to Boddy's analysis, able to influence the moral climate of the whole organization and wield considerable power. He closes with a damning indictment. It is psychopaths, he concludes, who are to blame for the global financial crisis, because their single-minded pursuit of their own self-enrichment and self-aggrandizement to the exclusion of all other considerations has led to an abandonment of the old-fashioned concept of noblesse oblige, equality, fairness, or of any real notion of corporate social responsibility. There's no denying he might well be onto something. On the other hand, however, there's society in general, proclaims Charles Elson, head of the Weinberg Center for Corporate Governance at the University of Delaware, who proposes that rather than laying the blame solely at the door of the corporate fat cats, it should instead also be pinned on a culture of moral malfeasance, in which truth is stretched on a rack of sententious self-interest and ethical boundaries blurred way beyond anything of conscionable cartographical interest. The watershed, according to Elson, was President Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky, and the fact that his administration, his family, and, to a large extent, his legacy, survived relatively intact in the aftermath. Be that as it may, honor and trust continue to falter elsewhere. The police are under fire for institutional racism, sport is under fire for the widespread use of performance-enhancing drugs, and the church is under fire for sexually abusing minors. The law itself has even gotten in on the act. At the Elizabeth Smart kidnapping trial in Salt Lake City, the attorney representing Brian David Mitchell, the homeless street preacher and self-proclaimed prophet who abducted, raped, and kept the 14-year-old Elizabeth captive for 9 months, according to Smart's testimony, he raped her pretty much every day over that period, by the way, urged the sentencing judge to go easy on his client on the grounds that Ms. Smart overcame it, survived it, triumphed over it. When the courts start whipping up that kind of tune, the dance could wind up anywhere. Generation Me. I put it to Pinker over lunch at the Harvard Faculty Club that we've got a bit of a conundrum on our hands. On the one hand, we have evidence that society is becoming less violent, while on the other, there's evidence that it's getting more psychopathic. He raises a good point. Okay, let's say that society is becoming more psychopathic, he counters. That doesn't necessarily entail that there's going to be an upsurge in violence. The majority of psychopaths, as far as I understand it, are actually nonviolent. They inflict predominantly emotional rather than physical pain. Of course, if psychopathy really starts getting a toehold, then we might see a minimal increase in violence compared to what we would have seen, say, 40 or 50 years ago. But what's probably more likely is that we'll start to detect a difference in the pattern of that violence. It might, for example, become more random or more instrumental. I think that society is going to have to get very psychopathic indeed for us to start living up to how we were, say, back in the Middle Ages. And from a purely practical point of view, that level of manifestation is simply not attainable. It wouldn't surprise me one bit to find that subtle fluctuations in personality or interpersonal style have been occurring over the past few decades. But the etiquette of modern civilization are far too deeply ingrained in us, far too embedded within our better natures, to be subverted by a swing, or what's probably more likely, a nudge toward the dark side. Pinker's right about psychopathy not being sustainable over the long term. As we saw with the aid of game theory in the previous chapter, it's a biological non-starter. He's also right about changes in the motivation for violence. In a recent study by the Crime and Justice Center at King's College London, 120 convicted street robbers were asked, quite simply, why they did it. Their answers revealed a great deal about modern British street life. Kicks, spur-of-the-moment impulses, status, and financial gain, in precisely that order of importance. Exactly the kind of casual, callous behavior patterns one often sees in psychopaths. So are we witnessing the rise of a sub-psychopathic minority for whom society doesn't exist? A new breed of individual with little or no conception of social norms, no respect for the feelings of others, and scant regard for the consequences of their actions? Might Pinker be right about those subtle fluctuations in modern personality structure and a nefarious nudge to the dark side? If the results of a recent study by Sarah Conrath and her team at the University of Michigan's Institute for Social Research are anything to go by, then the answer to these questions is yes. In a survey that has so far tested 14,000 volunteers, Conrath has found that college students' self-reported empathy levels, as measured by the Interpersonal Reactivity Index, have actually been in steady decline over the previous three decades, since the inauguration of the scale, in fact, back in 1979. A particularly pronounced slump has, it turns out, been observed over the past 10 years. College kids today are about 40% lower in empathy than their counterparts of 20 or 30 years ago, Conrath reports. More worrying still, according to Gene Twenge, a professor of psychology at San Diego State University, is that during this same period, students' self-reported narcissism levels have, in contrast, gone in the other direction. They've shot through the roof. Many people see the current group of college students, sometimes called Generation Me, Conrath continues, as one of the most self-centered, narcissistic, competitive, confident, and individualistic in recent history. Hardly surprising, then, that the former head of the British Armed Forces, Lord Dannett, has recently championed the notion that recruits undergo a moral education as part of their basic training. So lacking are many in a basic core value system. People haven't had the same exposure to traditional values which previous generations did, Dannett articulates. So we feel it's important people have a moral baseline. Throw them in the army, they used to say of delinquents. Not anymore. They've got enough of them already. Precisely why this downturn in social values should have come about is not entirely clear. A complex concatenation of environment, role models, and education is, as usual, doing the rounds. But the beginnings of an even more fundamental answer may lie in another study conducted by Jeffrey Zaks and his team at the Dynamic Cognition Laboratory, Washington University in St. Louis. With the aid of fMRI, Zax and his co-authors peered deep inside the brains of a bunch of volunteers as they read stories. What they found provided an intriguing insight into the way our brain constructs our sense of self. Changes in characters' locations, e.g., went out of the house into the street, were associated with increased activity in regions of the temporal lobes involved in spatial orientation and perception, while changes in the objects a character interacted with, e.g., picked up a pencil, produced a similar increase in a region of the frontal lobes known to be important for controlling grasping motions. Most importantly of all, however, changes in a character's goal elicited increased activation in areas of the prefrontal cortex, damage to which results in impaired knowledge of the order and structure of planned intentional action. Whenever we read a story, our level of engagement with it is such that we mentally simulate each new situation encountered in a narrative, according to lead researcher Nicole Spear. Our brains then interweave these newly encountered situations with knowledge and experience gleaned from our own lives to create an organic mosaic of dynamic mental syntheses. Reading a book carves brand new neural pathways into the ancient cortical bedrock of our brains. It transforms the way we see the world, makes us, as Nicholas Carr puts it in his recent essay, The Dreams of Readers, more alert to the inner lives of others. We become vampires without being bitten. In other words, more empathetic. Books make us see in a way that casual immersion in the internet and the quickfire virtual world it offers doesn't. Guilty, but not to blame. Back in Montreal, Bob Hare and I down another whiskey. On the subject of empathy and perspective taking, we've been talking about the emergence of neurolaw, a developing subdiscipline born out of the increasingly greater interest the courts are now taking in cutting-edge neuroscience. The Watershed study was published in 2002 and found that a functional polymorphism in a neurotransmitter metabolizing gene predicts psychopathic behavior in men who were mistreated as children. The gene in question, termed as mentioned previously the warrior gene by the media, controls the production of an enzyme called monoamine oxidase A, MAOA, low levels of which had previously been linked with aggressive behavior in mice. But Avshalom Kaspi and Terry Moffat of the Institute of Psychiatry, King's College London, pushed the envelope further. In a trailblazing study which assessed children through adolescence into adulthood, they discovered a similar pattern in humans. Boys who are abused or neglected and who possess a variation of the gene that codes for low levels of MAOA are at an increased risk as they get older of turning into violent psychopaths. On the other hand, those coming from a similarly dysfunctional background but who produce more of the enzyme rarely develop such problems. The implications of the discovery have percolated into the courtroom and could completely rewrite the fundamental rules of crime and punishment. Whether we're good or whether we're bad lies partly in our genes and partly in our environment. But since we don't choose either, are we free to choose at all? In 2006, Bradley Waldrop's defense attorney, Wiley Richardson, summoned Professor William Burnett, a forensic psychiatrist from Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, to the witness stand. Burnett had quite a job on his hands. Waldrop stood accused of one of the most brutal and heinous crimes in Tennessee's history. Following a visit from his estranged wife, their four children, and his estranged wife's friend to his trailer home, Waldrop, in his own words, snapped. He picked up his .22 rifle, proceeded to drill 8 peremptory holes in the friend's back, then sliced her head open with a machete. Turning the machete on his wife, he lopped off her finger, then stabbed and slashed her repeatedly before changing tack and beating her senseless with a shovel. Miraculously, his wife survived. But her friend, unfortunately, did not, which meant that Waldrop, if found guilty, faced the death penalty. Richardson had other ideas. Is it true, he asked Burnett, that the accused possesses the variation of the gene that codes for low levels of MAOA? Yes, replied Burnett. Is it also true, continued Richardson, that he was violently and repeatedly beaten by his parents as a child? Yes, replied Burnett. Then to what extent is the man who stands before you completely responsible for his actions? Persisted Richardson. To what extent has his free will been eroded by his genetic predisposition? It was a groundbreaking question, particularly for Bradley Waldrop, whose very existence, depending on the outcome, hung precariously in the balance. It got an equally groundbreaking answer. Enough, thought the court, to absolve him of first-degree murder and find him guilty of voluntary manslaughter. Enough, it turned out, for history to be made. The science of behavioral genomics had commuted an otherwise certain death sentence to life. The subject of neurolaw came up in the context of a wider discussion about the field of cultural neuroscience. The study of how societal values, practices, and beliefs shape and are shaped by genomic, neural, and psychological processes across multiple timescales and cultures. If society was becoming increasingly psychopathic, I wondered, was there a gene already at work out there churning out more psychopaths? Or was it a case, as Steven Pinker had elucidated in his Culture of Dignity argument, of customs becoming ever more socialized until they end up second nature? Hare suggests that it's probably a little of both, that psychopaths right now are on a bit of a roll, and that the more of a roll they get on, the more normative their behavior becomes. He points to the emergence of epigenetics, a hot new offshoot from the field of mainstream genetics, which, put simply, looks at changes in gene activity that don't actually involve structural alterations to the genetic code per se, but still get passed on to successive generations. These patterns of gene expression are governed by little switches that sit on top of the genome, and it's through tampering with these switches, rather than through intricate internal rewiring, that environmental factors like diet, stress, and even prenatal nutrition can have their say, can, like mischievous biological poltergeists, turn your genes on or off and make their presence felt in ancestral rooms long ago inherited from their original owner-occupiers. Hare tells me about a study conducted in Sweden back in the 1980s. In the first half of the 19th century, a remote area in the north of the country, Overkalix, was stricken by a sequence of poor and unpredictable harvests. Years of famine were duly interspersed with bumper years of plenty. Sifting through the data from meticulous agricultural archives and then comparing it with data from subsequent national health records, scientists uncovered something truly remarkable, an epidemiological inheritance pattern that turned the science of genetics on its head. The sons and the grandsons of men whose pre-puberty years just so happened to coincide with a time of famine had, it turned out, a decreased risk of dying from cardiovascular disease, such as stroke, high blood pressure, or coronary problems. On the other hand, however, the sons and grandsons of men whose prepubescence coincided with a bumper harvest had, in contrast, an increased risk of succumbing to diabetes-related illnesses. It was incredible. Through no direct agency of their own, successive generations of sons and grandsons had had their cardiovascular and endocrinological futures underwritten by the random ecological exigencies of an ancestral time long ago, before they were even born. So it is possible, I ask, in an attempt to draw everything together, Pinker and his cultural arbiters, Body and his corporate Attilas, and the whole epigenetics shebang, that psychopaths have rolled the dice and that over time, more and more of us are now rolling it with them? Hare orders another couple of shots. Not only that, he says, but over time, as you say, if the hand of epigenetics starts meddling behind the scenes, those dice will start to become more and more loaded. There's no doubt that there are elements of the psychopathic personality ideally suited to getting to the top. And once there, of course, they can start calling the tune to which others of their number are best suited to dance. Look at what's happened on Wall Street, for example. That's come from the top down. But as it takes hold, it enables those best equipped to deal with such an environment at lower levels of management to start making their way up. There was a writer back in the 60s, Alan Harrington, who thought that the psychopath was evolution's next step. The next trick that natural selection had up its sleeve as society becomes faster and looser. Maybe he's right. There's no way of telling right now, but there's certainly some interesting work being done in genetics labs at the moment. Did I tell you about this paper which shows that people with higher testosterone levels and long alleles on their serotonin transporter genes exhibit a suppressed amygdala response when faced with social dominance threats? That's a potential psychopath gene right there for you. You've got high aggression and low fear all rolled into one.
Context of white supremacy. That is the first audio segment for the Wisdom of Psychopaths, written by Kevin Dutton. When we get back to the second audio segment, we will be still in chapter five, and we'll be on the subheading Gary Gilmore's Eyes. Subheading Gary Gilmore's Eyes for chapter five. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you'd like to join the conversation, but you do not want to use your cell or you don't want to call in, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinytiny.cc/1race. And that is the number one. Address again, tinytiny.cc/1race. And that is the number one. When you put in that address, look on the left of the page. You will see a link for the free VOPE line. Click that link. It will open a small window on your screen. The first line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for a code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in a real name, nickname, press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live broadcast. It is the same procedure. If you would like to participate, you'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press *61. I will see your hand on the switchboard, and we will get you on the line. With that, if folks have additional commentary they would like to add, I think I did mention last week that Kevin Dutton probably has commented on President Trump, and he has. He wrote a number of articles and has been quoted regularly. He did the same testing that I talked about last week and that he mentioned in the book, where he got different biographers to go through and rate all of the presidents on the psychopathy inventory. And he said that they all ranked pretty high. He said both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton from last year that they both ranked very high on the psychopathy score. And he goes into detail about on some measures Trump ranked in front of Adolf Hitler. But I was very sure that with all of the accusations and people even to this very day saying that Donald Trump is a psychopath, that Mr. Kevin Dutton has been asked to weigh in on the subject matter. You can check for that online. I'm sure if you just do a search for Kevin Dutton, Donald Trump, you will find what I'm talking about. With that, folks who dialed in, if you have commentary you would like to share, feel free. Let's see. Mr. Demery Ford, you should be with us, and I'll nab other hands as we go.
Oh, I have it muted. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the callers. I got quite a few notes, but I'll try to be brief. First of all, let me get this out of the way. I wanted to say that all these experiments and research that's done on these volunteers, a lot of this is done in the prisons, in the prison systems, and I think some previous guests, Alan Hornsbloom and others, has spoke about researchers, the federal, state, and local prisons opening their doors to researchers, especially from the large pharmaceutical companies, and to the dismay of, you know, the prisoners. They had issues on morality and even a right to consent and all of that stuff. But it seems like a lot of these experiments are done in the prison system. And one particular one, I think that Kevin Dutton subject himself to the TMS, where they do this. Is that the one where they put something on your head and they measure the waves, the brain waves? Anyway, it all sounds, you know, I don't know. I can't see many Blacks or African Americans volunteering for any of these type experiments, especially with the history in our particular culture. But I also found that, you know, when he started to wonder the lack of empathy that psychopaths have, that if it was just a complete absence of apathy, or did they were they able to fake it or mask it? But come to find out, it's just like the person that you had on your show earlier. And, you know, I remember calling in. I can't remember the question I asked him, but I'm very interested in that, whether or not they could, you know, fake that. But it sounds like he was right on with exactly what Mr. Kevin Dutton is saying here, his personality. So it brings a little, validation to his particular claims. And, you should let him on. And then when they saw the needles being placed into different people's lips and mouths, feet, you know, people that were watching that, if you were part of the control volunteer group, your sensory perceptions would light up like a Christmas tree in those areas that correspond to, like, sympathy, you know, pain process and this and that. But when they did it with the experts, it's hardly a flicker, which you would probably come to the conclusion that, okay, that's pretty normal because these people were in the medical field. But it wasn't quite that simple because they did have elevated emotions in certain brain regions, and that caused emotion regulation. But what's significant is that it's less pleasant when they watch these things, even like fearfulness, disgusting, and erotic stimuli. Those and that social stress test, that peer stress test, I don't know who would volunteer for that. They give you just a short period of time, and you're supposed to prepare a job talk, and they tell you they're going to be looking at all your voice frequency analysis, the way you nonverbal communicate. That's enough to scare anybody, but I guess evidently a sociopath had hardly raised an eyebrow with him. So I believe that a lot of this is valid, you know, based upon the way he's put together these researches, and he's come to, he's made premises and then backed it up. It sounds pretty legit to me. But only thing I'll say is the part where he said that the only way I can describe it is to compare it to intoxication. Only it's an intoxication that sharpens rather than dulls the senses, an alternate state of consciousness that feeds on precision and clarity rather than fuzziness and incoherence. Perhaps super sane would be a better way of describing it. Less sinister, more, I don't know, spiritual. I think that is exactly what happens when whites are practicing racism. I think that it does something for them. You know, it gets them off in some kind of way. It's almost spiritual in nature. It has to be, or they would continue to do it and enjoy doing it. And it's been going on for thousands of years. Then, let's see, I wanted to say that, oh, the part about the epigenetics, I don't think that neural law would benefit non-whites, especially Black Americans. We wouldn't be given the benefits that Bradley Waldrop was given. Not at all. And I can relate to one incident. A guy was in a wheelchair here in D.C. The police beat him and drug him out of his wheelchair. So, oh, and Gus, I wanted to ask just one question. Do you think that Ta-Nehisi Coates took part of that question, that statement he had, that whites were deeply saddened and whatever he said about the racism, from the interpersonal reactivity index? Because at the bottom of 136, some of the questions on there is like, I often have tender, concerned feelings for people less fortunate than me, and I try to look at everybody's side of a different disagreement before I make a decision. That just came to my mind as he was reading that. And then one last thing I wanted to say, it was at the end, is that when he's talking about epigenetics, it says there's no doubt that there are elements of the psychopathic personality ideally suited to getting to the top. And once there, of course, they can start calling the tune to which others of their numbers are best suited to dance. And I think that describes Donald Trump to the T. And I'll mute my line, Gus. Thanks for taking the call. Give somebody else a chance.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demery. For quickly with Ta-Nehisi Coates, I think his question that he had been saying forever, or that I've been referencing for a good portion of time, white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism. He wrote this back in 2014. He may have. I couldn't verify. I did make an effort to ask him via social media about that sentence, how he came to that conclusion, but I did not get a response. So he certainly could have checked it out and adapted his phrasing and word choice from the questionnaire that you were talking about. I am not sure if anyone ever gets an opportunity to hear him or ask a question. Perhaps you could ask him about that. You know, how did he come to that conclusion and what influenced his thinking with regards to, I guess, coming to the opinion that white people are sincerely and greatly pained about racism and what they've done to black people. And I'm still of the opinion that that is inaccurate. Same opinion I had 3 years ago when he wrote that statement. Appreciate that, Mr. Demery. For Roz, if you had commentary, you should be with us as well.
Yes. Greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to Mr. Demery. You had some great, great insights. Thank you so much, Gus, for this this show, and thank you so much for Fridays. This book, this book is just bringing out so much information, and to me, it just really has put such a needlepoint focus on what it means to be white in a way that is just quite profound, even though this guy is a psychopathic white supremacist himself. And first, the clip you played with Sam Vaknin, he said what I've always said. And the thing was, he basically was saying that people with his condition, narcissism and psychopathy, are not fully human. I just took that to mean white people are not fully human. And I've said that all along. I said they're hominids. They walk on two legs. They, you know, they have two arms for the most part. They look like they would be classified as humans, but they're really not. And as you start to study their history and how they came into existence and the fact that they are a genetic mutation from East Indians who practice incest, and that created the genetic anomaly for them to become the modern whites that we know. And then other information that I found about the animal DNA they have, they're not fully human. They just tend to look that way. That's why I love that movie, They Live, because to me it just elucidates who and what they are in a profound way visually for someone who might not be able to visualize it for themselves. This book and the story of Jeffrey Dahmer reminds me of a documentary series that came on this summer. It's called American Ripper, and it was on the Discovery Channel. Of course, reading is more important than television, but I believe that this documentary gives such enriched insights into white supremacy and how it functions as a systemic issue that it just flabbergasted me. And what it's about is a guy named H.H. Holmes. He is America's first documented serial killer. And essentially, it follows him on a trail from Chicago area, where he committed numerous murders, all the way across this country, then across the pond to Britain, and then back here multiple times. And they're basically, it's one of his descendants who, through his family history research, has come to the conclusion that H.H. Holmes, America's first serial killer, is also Jack the Ripper. And it is one of the most profound documentaries I've seen. It was about 8 parts this summer that they had it with, that they showed. And if anybody wants to see this book elucidated in detail, especially to how the system functions, how the government helped him escape, how they purposefully turned a blind eye because he was white and because he was affluent and psychopathic, it's incredible. So I just wanted to just put that out there. I don't know if anyone else saw that documentary, but if they did, it will have a very similar effect on you if you were also to see the Jeffrey Dahmer, Dahmer on Dahmer documentary that I've mentioned previously on this particular book study club. Let me get into the text, because, man, I took copious notes, just like Mr. Demery said. I don't want to talk too long, but I know it's going to probably get in depth just because of the way that I've analyzed this information. It's just profound. So I'm going to start on page 119, where Mr. Dutton writes, here's one of the UK's top neurosurgeons on how he feels prior to going into the theater. Do I get nervous before a big operation? No, I wouldn't say so, but I guess it's like any other performance.
You have to get yourself psyched up. You need to remain concentrated and focused on the job at hand, not get distracted. You have to get it right. You know, you mentioned special forces a few moments ago, and actually the mentality of a surgeon and, say, that of an elite soldier about to storm a building or an airliner are possibly quite similar. In both cases, the job is referred to as an operation. In both cases, you tool up and don a mask. And in both cases, all the years of practice and training can never fully prepare you for that element of uncertainty as you make the first incision, that exhilarating split second of explosive entry, when you fold back the skin and suddenly realize you're in. And I found that to be very, very important, because he's describing how white people function all the time. He likened it to a performance, and I love the words that he used. You have to remain concentrated and focused on the job at hand, which is practicing racism, dominating and or killing black people. You cannot get distracted, and you have to get it right. And then he talks about the similarity between the mentality of a surgeon and that of an elite soldier, storming a building and things of that nature. Now, he also talks to, he says, in both cases, he referred to the job as an operation. Now, operation is a term used in warfare, and it's a term used in medicine. So that means medicine is warfare. It's no different than when you look at entertainment, they use the term theater. In medicine, when you are being operated on, they call the operating room a theater. And back in the early 1900s, it used to be a theater. When you go to war, whatever country you're fighting in, they call it the theater of. So the theater of Iraq, the theater of Afghanistan, so on and so forth. These words that we use as everyday innocuous terms are terms of warfare that have been introduced to our word verbiage and cultural verbiage in a way that seems innocuous, but it is indicative of the system of white supremacy, the way that it functions. So I just found that particular phraseology and the terms that he used, just tooling up and donning a mask. Yeah, white people tool up, as in the streets. We used to say tooling up means grabbing the guns, you know, getting them loaded and getting ready to get busy. And you don a mask, you know, you give the impression that you are, and in actuality, of course, in surgery, you put on a mask in order to protect yourself from blood or whatever bodily fluids, as well as stop any of your bodily fluids from falling into a gaping wound if you're a surgeon. But they also don a psychological mask where they give the fallacy of normalcy while, like Jeffrey Dahmer, they're killing and eating black people. So this, I think that is one of the most important sections that we've read in the book thus far as elucidating the psychology of psychopathy and white supremacy. On page 126, he writes, "I agree, but I can't help but think of Johnny, where he might fall on the scale. James Bond was licensed to kill, but he didn't kill indiscriminately. He killed when he had to and didn't blink an eye." And that brought me to Jeffrey Dahmer. You know, he didn't kill indiscriminately. He was able to choose in a predatory, the apex predator that white people are. He was able to apply that laser-like focus on picking victims accurately every time. At least 17 times, and they believe he's committed more murders than has come out. So this goes to show you they perfected that, and that, of course, he didn't kill indiscriminately. He was addicted to it. So that ties into what Mr. Demley talked about. You know, when they mistreat, abuse, kill, whatever you call it, black people, they receive a dopamine response. And I believe it's the amygdala that facilitates that dopamine response. The dopamine response is the response of pleasure and happiness, the same spot that's triggered when a person uses drugs or a person has sex or a person falls in love. All of these things, the great grandiose feelings of pleasure are generated from that dopamine. And for them, the abuse and murder of black people is the highest level drug they can consume. And that's where I emphatically agree with Mr. Demery, and I thought his observation was quite brilliant. On page 130, he writes here, "Hare's position makes a great deal of sense to those who take even a passing interest in what they read in the newspapers, see on TV, or stumble upon online. In Japan in 2011, a 17-year-old boy parted with one of his own kidneys so he could go out and buy an iPad. in China, following an incident in which a two-year-old baby was left stranded in the middle of a marketplace and run over not once but twice as passersby went casually about their business. An appalled electorate has petitioned the government to pass a quote-unquote Good Samaritan law to prevent such a thing from ever happening again. Now, if you study the history of China and Japan, these were pretty much they functioned as a communal collective, and it was very homogenous. So they're the type of people where if you stand out in any way that is considered abnormal from the cultural norm, you will be shunned. And I've seen documentaries about it, and I've studied Asian culture, especially Far Eastern culture, for quite a while, as far as just their different texts and stories that they tell about themselves. So basically, this paragraph is elucidating that white people are, like I said, anthropomorphic cancer. That means cancer in human form. So every other being, especially real human beings that they come in contact with, they infect with disease, not just literally, but also mentally. So they're showing that these people from the Far East, just like we are here, have been infected with the same disease that white people have. So we now start to exhibit the same traits. That is the linchpin of anti-blackness amongst black people in a system of white supremacy. Page 132, he writes, a culture of honor, the readiness to take revenge, gave way to a culture of dignity, the readiness to control one's emotions. These ideals originated in explicit instructions that cultural arbiters gave to aristocrats and noblemen, allowing them to differentiate themselves from the villains and boors. But they were then absorbed into the socialization of younger and younger children until they became second nature. The standard also trickled down from the upper classes to the bourgeoisie that strove to emulate them, and from them to the lower classes, eventually becoming a part of the culture as a whole. So this culture of honor is exactly what was found to be the root of violence amongst black people in this country. And that is elucidated in the book I've discussed a thousand times. I hope we read it on this show. It's called All God's Children by Fox Butterfield, that black people following the culture of dueling and honor, the honor system of whites in the South, started to practice this behavior on each other. So for simple things like stepping on someone's sneaker, you might get your brains blown out amongst black people in specific eras of our history. Now, when you look at this, basically what they're talking about, the culture of honor is the less refined system of white supremacy. That's when you had the more powerful whites dueling with the less powerful whites for dominance, who's going to be in control through physical violence. Then you had what he calls a culture of dignity. I call that refined white supremacy, where you control your emotions publicly, but you might scheme clandestinely to make sure that whatever payback you had for that person, you got it done. So what he's explaining there is literally the transition from overt violent white supremacy to covert, very, very deeply refined murderous white supremacy that we're living with today. And now we're just kind of between both poles, in the proverbial poles of the more refined and less refined versions of white supremacy that we deal with today as a people globally. So I find that to be important. I'm going to try and wind this down because I know I've been talking a while. Hopefully I'll get a chance to say some more later. Let me see if I can pull this out real quick. Okay, so it says here on 134, of course, once in situ, such corporate Attilas are then, according to Bodhi's analysis, able to influence the moral climate of the whole organization and wield considerable power. He closes with a damning indictment. It is psychopaths, he concludes, who are to blame for the global financial crisis because their single-minded pursuit of their own self-enrichment and self-aggrandizement to the exclusion of all other considerations has led to an abandonment of the old-fashioned concept of noblesse oblige, equality, fairness, and of any notion of corporate social responsibility. There is no denying he may well be onto something. Now, with this particular statement, he's not just talking about any small group of people. He's talking about white people. What he's telling me here is as long as white people are in charge, they're going to cause this type of influence psychologically on the entire society. And if you see from the top, Donald Trump, the quintessential psychopath, down to the average white person on the street, This is the mind state. They are all the same. It doesn't matter how rich they are, how poor they are, what proverbial class they think they come from. As long as they classify as white, they are psychopathic. And he's elucidating this in very slick and secret ways due to the way that he functions as a psychopathic white supremacist. I will stop there. I hope I get to chime in later because I have a couple other things. Like I said, I took copious notes. But thank you again for such an incredible book. And just thank you for being you, Gus. I appreciate you. I'll meet my line.
Much obliged, Roz. Thanks for the documentary recommendations as well. Let me check in our previous narrator, Mel. She read, or actually she's read numerous texts, including just reading Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, and Assata Shakur's biography from some years back. Good to hear from you as well. If you had commentary, feel free.
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so some of my notes from this week include from the first section of the reading, I think he mentions like the idea of selective risk or brutality, where he says like some psychopaths, there are things they would do like in a courtroom, but they wouldn't do them, you know, otherwise. I think the exact example he used, like a psychopath wouldn't go into a bad neighborhood or something like that. And I'm just thinking, if I'm guessing his definition of bad neighborhood is correct, then I'm thinking, or, you know, maybe an impoverished neighborhood to some extent, I'm thinking a white supremacist is a psychopath to me. And I think they would go into a bad neighborhood. It's like a classical trope in a movie at this point of just like two racist white men in a pickup truck throwing alcohol bottles off their truck in like these movies talking about like Old South and Jim Crow in these rural areas. Like, I think white supremacists absolutely would go into a neighborhood to just do a quote-unquote bad neighborhood or an impoverished neighborhood, in my opinion, to just do random violent incidents. I don't think they have that fear all the time. I guess I just wonder about that statement. I think he talked about how today we are less violent than we were in the past. Like, the violence rate seems to be falling, I guess, except among women's criminality, I think he said. And I'm just thinking that maybe some people exported their violence. The violence rates that he talk about that he talks about that get lowered, he seems to only mention European countries. And I'm thinking that they also don't really call all wars that they participate in technically wars. Some people would say that we're currently within a quote-unquote war with maybe where soldiers or what terms is at large. Or maybe some people have thought that maybe Ebola or some viruses that appear randomly in Africa might be forms of warfare. I think the entire maybe Native American genocide might not be called war. Slavery seemed kind of like, I mean, I'm not sure what he's classifying as a war or what he means when he says that violence rates have fallen. But I did notice that he seems to only focus on European violence rates falling. And I just think it's because they exported their violence. I think he uses the example of the lady from The Weakest Link at some point, and I think he calls her a dominatrix diva. And I've been getting this vibe all along of sort of a worship of psychopaths, and maybe, okay, it's, I mean, he doesn't call her a harpy, he doesn't call her an old crone. I mean, he says she's a dominatrix diva. Diva seems like a power symbol to me, and maybe it's just humor. I don't know, but I think humor says a lot about maybe what you really think in your mind. And it's just furthering evidence that maybe there's a worship of people or an admiration of psychopaths going on here. I'm just thinking also of when I think he said his dad and one of his best friends was a psychopath growing up. I'm just, that's so close to home for you not to have a, sort of an infatuation or soft spot. He uses the example of the Middle Ages, and I think he talks about how back then violence levels were higher. And I find that I think it might just be slightly removed from context for me, because when you think about, I guess, the Middle Ages and stuff like that, we're talking about like historically high levels of murder and I guess psychopathy, and it just removes the context of things like, you know, tainted meat or mercury poisoning that was pretty common, or the fact that the only way to get the color green in clothing back then was like from a form of arsenic. I mean, there were like women that wore headdresses that contained enough arsenic to kill 60 people. They put arsenic on food back then because it was the way you got the color green in, I believe, the Victorian time period. They put it on cakes. They put it on baby dresses. I mean, so when he talks about how violence levels were much higher back then, I'm not sure if it's more of a social thing than it might have been an actual chemical, biological reason for that. And I did look up the president's scale you were talking about, where I think the presidents get ranked on psychopathy. And I found that Lincoln is kind of in the middle, I think, on one blog that I found, but then he's kind of high on another one. And I was just thinking, I just saw a documentary on YouTube called The Dakota 38 about, I think it's in North Dakota, there was a rebellion of Native Americans against the encroaching, I think, European population that wanted to settle there and basically take the land. And they were literally starving the Native Americans to death. They wouldn't allow them to leave this small bit of property for food. And so they rebelled, and they were basically shipped out on cattle trains, shipped on a boat, and moved basically to North Dakota, where they ended up. But in response to this rebellion, where the Native Americans rose up, Abraham Lincoln went to North Dakota to personally hang 38 of the Native Americans there. And he did this the day after Christmas. And I'm just thinking, I can't imagine it being just snowy and cold, and I want to be indoors and warm and maybe with my pheasant meat or whatever like that. And then the day after, you just go personally pull the lever on 38 people. And I found that really psychopathic. So I'm not sure. It's a free YouTube documentary if anyone wants to check it out. I think it's also called The Largest Mass Hanging in History, but I have not done as much research into the events that occurred after Nat Turner's rebellion, so I do wonder about that number. On another list of note, I did find that Idi Amin was rated worse than Hitler as a psychopath in history, a psychopathic leader, and I thought that was strange. But he wasn't rated as bad as Saddam Hussein or Henry VIII. I think I'll send that. Those are all my points from this section. There's when he talks about lawyers' disinterest and how they just, it's so easy to just throw a rape victim under the bus completely, or it's so easy to just, villainize a rape victim in court. I had a point about that, but I haven't really written it together in a concise manner yet. That was all.
Appreciate that. Mel, if other folks have comments, questions, you want to make sure you get in. We have about 15 minutes before we get to the second audio clip. Go ahead and get your hand up now if you have a comment, question you want to get in before we start segment two. A few of the quick notes that I wanted to make sure I got in. Also, there was a study I saw today where they are asserting that psychopaths prefer hip-hop to other music genres. Now, this came out just a couple months ago, September 2017. They say tracks by Eminem and Blackstreet were more frequently favored by psychopaths. I'm just going to read a little bit. It says, according to Pascal Wallach, who led the NYU study, psychopaths make up less than 1% of the U.S. population, and they're often not the deranged serial killers that are depicted in TV and film. The media portrays psychopaths as axe murderers and serial killers, but the reality is that they are not obvious. They are not like the Joker in Batman. Wallach told The Guardian, they might be working right next to you, and they blend in. They are like a psychological dark matter. Believe it or not, this isn't the first study to link psychopaths and hip-hop music. Kevin Dutton, a psychologist at Oxford, has surveyed the musical tastes of more than 3 million people and came up with similar results. I'll stop there. I don't know if he's going to go into his hip-hop study during the book, but I will post the link if you want to check it out and with regards to the music study. And apparently there's a whole documentary on Channel 4, which is a British television network, where they have Kevin Dutton in and they spend the whole segment talking about psychopathy. I can post that on my Facebook page if people are interested in checking that out, the Channel 4 version. Back to the text from chapter 4. Some of the notes that I took, I thought it was, TMS is transcranial magnetic screening. I think Mr. Demery 4 mentioned that. And I would just couple all of that together. There are a lot of studies here. Not that I'm surprised by that. Again, Kevin Dutton, he's a professor at Oxford, one of the most renowned white institutions in the world. So I'm not surprised about that. But I mean, when Mr. Fuller says that race soldiers, they go to the bottom of the ocean to study how to keep their foot on the neck of black people forever. Think about this book where Kevin Dutton, they just said that he studied the musical tastes of 300 million people.
make sure I didn't say 3 million, sorry, not 300 million, 3 million people, still a substantial number of counting. And all the different studies that they got here, you got this guy riding around with $2 million of equipment so he can go to prisons and study people. White people are not ignorant about racism, white supremacy. I mean, this is an extraordinary amount of time and energy to do studying about psychopaths themselves. Where in the text he says, in fact, make sure I get the whole sentence here, suggesting that psychopaths, rather than having an impairment in recognizing the emotions of others, indeed have a talent for it. I thought that was really important. I think some of you all touched on. Sam Bachman said the exact same thing, where he said he feels that he and psychopaths in general are very, very good at discerning, paying very close attention to other people so that they can pick up their desires, their wishes, their fears when they're excited, just so that they have more data, more information to better manipulate and abuse you. That's something that I think whites, they are extraordinary at. I think we've talked about them coming amongst black people to study us and pick, even mentioning Eminem, where he, I think, spent a lot of time around black people and studying black people so that they can mimic, fit in things that we are doing and to use that to further support the system of racism. Continuing where, see the next portion, the whole portion where the surgeon, I think Roz did an eloquent job dissecting the similarities where everything is framed as battle. Everything is framed as war, whether it's a physician going into an operating room, whether it's a football game that is supposed to be about amusement and entertainment, it's Hail Marys and bombs. Everything is put in the context of warfare and battle and killing. And I mean, if we're talking warfare, we're not talking about killing one person. We're talking about killing as many people as possible. Mass violence, where that's just consistent, where that is the frame, it seems to be the most consistent and the most comfortable framework for how we're going to think about any situation. And this is not the first time where he's had a doctor talking about going in, ostensibly a healer, but the way that they contextualize the situation, this is battle. Give me my scalpel. We're going to war. The next session, next segment, moving into chapter 5, Make Me a Psychopath. This whole notion of whether or not society is becoming more or less psychopathic, for me, as long as there's a system of white supremacy, it's difficult to gauge. So, I mean, if we rewind 300 years in this part of the world, you have formal old school plantation enslavement of black people. It's difficult for me to say that this part of the world was less psychopathic at that time than it is now. It's also difficult for me to say that things have gotten better given everything that we are experiencing now in the era of Charles Manson, Jeffrey Dahmer, Donald Trump, the list goes on, Dylann Roof. It's difficult for me to say that things are less psychopathic now. It just kind of looks a little different, but it seems, at least to me, it seems to be basically the same type of thing with regards to white culture, system of white supremacy, and how they're operating. Where I thought it was significant where he says, I think if you're looking for evidence that society is becoming more psychopathic, the recent hike in female criminality is particularly revealing. And don't even get me started on Wall Street. I almost included a segment because I asked Sam Bachman about this. And he said that he thinks as women gain closer access to being on par with regards to power that males have, power that females has, he says as that inequity gets lessened, that he thinks you will have higher instances of psychopathy with females, that they, he says he already sees evidence that they're exerting more of the same behaviors as males, and he thinks there'll be more of that. I think with whites, If you're talking about white women specifically, I think that already is the case. I think there's lots of evidence about that, whether he's talking about the dominatrix from the television show. Hillary Clinton, as I said, even though she didn't win the presidency, he did rate her, and she also was supposed to be very high on his scale of psychopathy. I'm sure there are many others that he could find if you go through and do the work. But I thought that that segment was important. Let's see. Got a mention of Donald Trump with The Apprentice. I think also with just television, I think now when he was talking about the rates of murders and violence from years ago in comparison to now, I think that now because of television, you have such access to visual violence that did not exist 300 years ago. You couldn't turn on your television and sit back and binge watch The Walking Dead, for example, for a whole weekend and just watch killing and slaughtering and, you know, knocking people's eyeballs out and as much violence as possible. He mentioned the film Saw. You didn't have that. So that has, in some respects, you don't have as much daily direct violence as you did maybe 200, 300 years ago. But we're talking this part of the world where you have formal plantation slavery. But you still have tons of violence and brutality, and you have simulated violence on a constant basis. I think that shouldn't be discounted as well. When he's talking about all of the investment scams and what have you as evidence that things might be worse, that's one where it's difficult for me to concur with that. I am reminded, I think Thomas in New York recently mentioned Texas. When we read The Half Has Never Been Told, Edward Baptist, roughly a year ago, in that text where he says GTT, if folks recall, white people absconding without paying their debts, they would scoop up their Negros and head off to Texas and start over again. Whites being unscrupulous, conniving, stealing from other whites, doing whatever they need to get over and rob and fleece them. They've been doing that forever. I don't think that it's on a greater scale now than what they were doing at that time. If we recall then, you had banks that were going under because people were not paying their debts. People would come in and borrow lots of money so they could go out and buy their Negroes and get their plantations running, and then things didn't work out. They wouldn't pay the money back. This has been long running under the system of racism, white supremacy. It's hard for me to say that things are worse now than what they were. And I think also with regards to information, I think people can be much more informed. You tend to hear about these scandals and incidents much quicker than you would at the time. It's not like you had the type of resources in 19th century so that you could hear about every white scoundrel who didn't pay their debts or what have you and ran off to Texas. When he says, give the whole sentence here, but also in the mix is so-called guerrilla accounting, as Wall Street and the London Stock Exchange expected continued gains and the speed of complexity of business increased exponentially. Rule bending and obfuscation suddenly became de rigueur, Latin, meaning that's just an accepted part of business. I think that has always been the case for the system of white supremacy, where whites, they fight with one another, they mistreat one another, they will look to get over on one another anytime that they can. The only thing binding them together is we are supposed to be working together in dominating the dark people on the planet. But I don't think them having some sort of dedication to rule bending, I don't think that that's new or anything strange. Well, he's talking about Bill Clinton and saying maybe that's part of what changed with regards to an increase in psychopathy. I could not contain my laughter when whites have been the delectable Negro raping, pillaging. That has been going on forever, even if we want to talk about from the White House with John F. Kennedy, where it seems lots and lots of people were well aware of his Monica Lewinsky's. That is absurd to put this on Bill Clinton to say, oh, yeah, because he was sleep, or to even theorize because he got caught sleeping around that maybe that led to the moral fiber degrading in the U.S. or worldwide. Come on now. I was reminded of Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, just the section where the lawyer was talking about this guy, I guess, who had abducted and raped the Elizabeth Smart case, where he was saying that this guy, we should go easy because Miss Smart overcame, that is the sort of crazy talk that is only afforded a white murderer. If you had a black person who missed the parking ticket or was jaywalking, they would not get that sort of empathy. They would not get that sort of sanctity. We throw the book at them, put them under the jail. I will stop there. We have just a few minutes before we get to the second audio segment. If I know a couple folks said that they had other comments that they wanted to get in. If you want to take about a minute each, if you have a quick comment, and then we can get to the second audio segment. Or if folks don't have commentary, that's fine too. Did anybody have anything quickly that they could get in before we get to audio segment number two?
I wanted to say something. It's just a section that I wanted to read too, and then make a brief comment. One was, okay. It's on page 138, where he says, reading a book carves brand new neural pathways into the ancient cortical bedrock of our brains. It transforms the way we see the world, makes us, as Nicholas Carr puts it in his recent essay, the dreams of readers. More alert to the inner lives of others. We become vampires without being bitten. Again, like you talk about the metaphor, that makes no sense. In other words, more empathetic. Books make us see in a way that casual immersion in the internet and the quicksilver virtual world it offers does not. I think this really, again, speaks to the brilliance of the illustrious grandsire, Dr. Welsing. I love reading books. And again, he's basically touting reading physical books probably over virtual text. And this elucidates, again, make that brain strong, exercise it as much as possible. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that. We will get to the second audio. If other folks have commentary, you can share after the second audio segment has concluded. So again, we are picking up. We're in chapter 5, and the subheading, Gary Gilmore's Eyes, kind of the middle of chapter 5. I can't give a page number because I have the ebook. With that, we will get started. Kevin Dutton, The Wisdom of Psychopaths. Context of White Supremacy. This is audio segment number 2.
Gary Gilmore's Eyes. I glance at my watch. It's a little after 9, and the bar is filling up. As an amusing backdrop, Gary Gilmore's Eyes by The Adverts is playing, a post-punk ditty from yesteryear in which the singer muses on what it would be like to see through them. It's an interesting question, to which someone knows the answer. Following his execution, Gilmore had requested that his eyes be used for transplant purposes. Within hours of his death, in compliance with his wishes, two people received his corneas. Gilmore, of course, is one of criminal history's super psychopaths, one of that rare subbreed of the species with all of the dials on the mixing deck turned up to max. In January of 1977, the former shoe salesman was executed by a firing squad in the small and otherwise unremarkable town of Draper, Utah. The previous July, at a gas station a few miles up the road, he'd gunned down an attendant for reasons he wasn't quite sure of. Then he'd gone to see a movie with his girlfriend. The next day, as an encore, he'd shot a motel clerk in the head. 6 months later, after a final repast of hamburgers, eggs, and potatoes, he was facing the music in Utah State Prison. There were 5 in the firing squad. The prison governor tightened the leather straps around Gilmore's head and chest and fixed a circular cloth target over his heart. He then withdrew from the execution chamber and pressed his face against the cool, clear glass of the observation suite. There was nothing now for Gilmore save a miraculous, last-minute reprieve, and neither miracles nor reprieves were all that common in Draper at the time. Besides, a couple of months earlier, Gilmore had dropped his appeal. He had, or so he'd told his attorney, actually wanted to die. It was 8 in the morning when the firing squad picked up their rifles. Before, as is tradition, pulling a black corduroy hood over his head, the governor, as is also tradition, asked Gilmore if there were any last words. Gilmore stared straight ahead, his eyes colder than a great white's, as the inaudible thunder of death rumbled across his soul. "Let's do it," he said. As the song plays out, I turn, somewhat pensively, to Hare. "I wonder what it would be like to see through Gilmore's eyes," I said. "I mean, for real. If someone could turn you into a psychopath for an hour, would you do it?" He laughs. "Maybe I would now," he drawls. "At my age. But they'd have to get the keys to my BMW off me first." We finish off our drinks and go our separate ways. The song has got me thinking, and I prowl around old Montreal with a crazy idea buzzing around my head. What about that study by Ahmed Karim, the one in which he'd made people better liars by zapping their moral decision-making regions, their anterior prefrontal cortices, with transcranial magnetic stimulation? If you can turn one of the dials up higher, then why not several others? Magnetic personality. TMS was first developed by Dr. Anthony Barker and his colleagues at the University of Sheffield in 1985. But it's got a longer history than that. In fact, the science behind the electrical stimulation of the nerves and muscles has been around since the 1780s, some 200 years before Barker plugged himself in, when Italian anatomist and physician Luigi Galvani and his compatriot Alessandro Volta first discovered, with the aid of a simple electrical generator and a pair of severed frog's legs, that the nerves were not water pipes, as Descartes had conjectured, but electrical conductors that ferried information round the nervous system. Since then, things have come a long way. The inaugural application of TMS by Barker and his team comprised an elementary demonstration of the conduction of nerve impulses from the motor cortex to the spinal cord by stimulating simple muscle contractions. Nowadays, it's a different story, and TMS has widespread practical uses in both a diagnostic and a therapeutic capacity across a variety of neurological and psychiatric conditions, ranging from depression and migraine to strokes and Parkinson's disease. The basic premise of TMS is that the brain operates using electrical signals, and that, like any such system, it's possible to modify the way it works by altering its electrical environment. Standard equipment consists of a powerful electromagnet placed on the scalp that generates steady magnetic field pulses at specific pre-selected frequencies, and a plastic enclosed coil to focus those magnetic pulses down through the surface of the skull onto specially targeted, discreetly segregated brain regions, thus stimulating the underlying cortex. Now, one of the things that we know about psychopaths is that the light switches of their brains aren't wired up in quite the same way as the rest of ours, and that one area particularly affected is the amygdala, a peanut-sized structure located right at the very center of the circuit board. The amygdala, as we've learned previously in this book, is the brain's emotion control tower. It polices our emotional airspace and is responsible for the way we feel about things. But in psychopaths, a section of this airspace, the part that corresponds to fear, is empty. Using the light switch analogy, TMS may be thought of as a dimmer switch. As we process information, our brains generate small electrical signals. These signals not only pass through our nerves to work our muscles, but also meander deep within our brains as ephemeral electrical data shoals, creating our thoughts, memories, and feelings. TMS can alter the strength of these signals by passing an electromagnetic current through precisely targeted areas of the cortex. We can turn these signals either up or down, either help these data shoals on their way or impede their progress. Turn down the signals of the amygdala, of course, and as Ahmed Karim and his colleagues at the University of Tübingen did, to the brain's morality neighborhood, and you're well on the way to giving someone a psychopath makeover. Indeed, Leanne Young and her team at MIT have since kicked things up a notch and demonstrated that applying TMS to the right temporoparietal junction, a specific neural zip code within that neighborhood, has significant effects, not just on lying ability, but also on moral reasoning ability. I pick up the phone to my old friend Andy McNabb. He's on a week-long spree in the desert when I call, roaring around Nevada on a Harley V-Rod muscle. "No helmets," he booms. "Hey, Andy," I say. "You up for a little challenge when you get back?" "Course," he yells. "What is it?" "How about you and me go head-to-head in a test of cool in the lab, and I come out on top?" Manic laughter. "Love it," he says. "You're on. Slight problem, though, Kev. How the fuck do you think you're going to pull that one off?" "Simple," I say. Special Author Service. For those of you who've been living in a cave for the past 20 years, Andy McNabb was arguably the most famous British soldier to have served in Her Majesty's forces until Prince Harry hung up his polo mallet at Eton back in 2005. During the first Gulf War, Andy commanded Bravo 20, an 8-man special forces patrol that was assigned the task of gathering intelligence on underground communication links between Baghdad and northern Iraq and tracking and destroying Scud missile launchers along the Iraqi main supply route in the area. But soon, the boys had other fish to fry. A couple of days after insertion, the patrol was compromised by a goat herd tending his flock, and in time-honored fashion, beat it 185 miles across the desert toward the Syrian border. Only one of them made it. Three were killed, and the other four, including Andy, were picked up at various points along the way by the Iraqis. Suffice it to say that none of their captors were ever going to have their own talk shows or make their mark in the annals of cosmetic surgery. It's generally accepted that there are better ways of putting a person at ease than by stubbing your cigarette out on their neck, and better ways of breaking and remodeling their jawline than with the sun-baked butt of an AK-47. Thanks to more advanced techniques back home in the UK, Andy's mouth now packs more porcelain than all of the bathrooms in Buckingham Palace put together. He should know. In 1991, he went there to collect the Distinguished Service Medal from the Queen. The medal was just the beginning. In 1993, in a book that bore their name, Andy told the story of the patrol in all its gruesome detail and defined, pretty much overnight, both the genre and the shape of the modern military memoir. In the words of the Special Air Services, SAS, commanding officer at the time, the story of Bravo 20 will remain in regimental history forever. He wasn't kidding. In fact, it's now become part of a wider cultural history, and Andy has become a brand. On a night flight to Sydney several years ago, we routed over Afghanistan. Down below, in the deep, dangerous darkness between the mountains of the Hindu Kush, I noticed, through the intermittent cloud cover, tiny pinpricks of light. What the hell were they, I wondered? The flickering campfires of age-old nomadic pastoralists? The secret hideouts of one-eyed Taliban warlords. Right on cue, the pilot switched on the intercom. "For those of you on the right-hand side of the aircraft," he intoned, "you should just about be able to make out the laptops of the SAS as they bash out their latest bestsellers." The intercom crackled off, and everyone laughed. Andy would have, too, if he'd been there. But I think he was down there in Afghanistan at the time. One of the first things you learn about Andy, and you learn it pretty quickly, is that he couldn't give a shit about anything. Nothing is sacred, and nothing remotely fazes him. "I was a couple of days old when they found me," he explains, as we meet for the first time at London Bridge Station. "Just round the corner from here, in fact, on the steps of Guy's Hospital. Apparently, I was wrapped in a Harrods bag." "You're joking," I say. "Seriously?" "Yeah," he says, "straight up." "Shit," I say. "Incredible. I had you down as more of a TJ Maxx man myself." "You cheeky bastard," he roars. "Nice one. I like it." We've teamed up as part of a radio show I'm putting together for the BBC. The show is called Extreme Persuasion, and I'm interested in learning if certain psychopathic characteristics might come in handy in the SAS, Like, for instance, not giving a shit about anything. I'm not disappointed. If you're thinking of joining, I'll tell you something for nothing. If you've got issues over your parentage, you're better off staying at home. One of the first things you notice on camp is the banter, Andy tells me. It's pretty much constant. Everyone is always slagging everyone else off, taking the piss. And like most things in the regiment, there's a good reason for that. If you're captured, you're taught to be the gray man, to act tired and out of it, to give your interrogators the impression that you don't know shit, that you're of little use to them. Now, if your captors are any good, they'll start to look for weaknesses. They'll look for the tiniest of reactions, fleeting micro-expressions, infinitesimal eye movements that might give away your true mental state. And if they find anything, then take it from me. That's that, mate. It's game over. Put it this way, if you've got a problem with the size of your dick, an Iraqi interrogation suite probably isn't the best place to find out. So in the regiment, nothing is sacred. The slagging is purely functional. It's an efficient way of building up psychological immunity. It inoculates you against the kind of shit they can throw at you if you're captured. It's the right kind of wrong, if you see what I mean. Plus, you know, there's nothing like a good wind-up, really, is there? No, I guess not. But mental toughness isn't the only characteristic that Special Forces soldiers have in common with psychopaths. There's also fearlessness. A couple of years ago, on a beautiful spring morning 12,000 feet above Sydney's Bondi Beach, I performed my first free-fall skydive. The night before, somewhat the worse for wear in one of the city's waterfront bars, I texted Andy for some last-minute advice. "Keep your eyes open and your arse shut," came the reply. I did. Just. But performing the same feat at night, in the theater of war, over a raging ocean from twice the altitude, and carrying 200 pounds of equipment, is a completely different ballgame altogether. And if that's not enough, there's also the piss-taking to contend with. Even at 30,000 feet, the party's going strong. "We used to have a laugh," Andy recalls. "Mess about. You know, we'd throw the equipment out ahead of us and see if we could catch up with it. Or on the way down, we'd grab each other from behind in a bear hug and play chicken, see who'd be the first to peel off and pull the cord. It was all good fun." Right, if you say so, Andy. But what wasn't much fun was the killing. I asked Andy whether he ever felt any regret over anything he'd done, over the lives he'd taken on his numerous secret missions around the world. "No," he replies, matter-of-factly, his arctic blue eyes, just for the record, there are eyes behind the bars you see in the photos, showing not the slightest trace of emotion. "You seriously don't think twice about it. When you're in a hostile situation, the primary objective is to pull the trigger before the other guy pulls the trigger. And when you pull it, you move on. Simple as that. Why stand there dwelling on what you've done? Go down that route, and chances are the last thing that goes through your head will be a bullet from an M16. The regiment's motto is, who dares wins. But sometimes, it can be shortened to fuck it. Bonds of detachment. Put like this, it's not difficult to envisage how such pathological poise, such conscienceless composure, might actually come in handy in certain circumstances, how it might, at times, actually be construed as adaptive. One of Andy's compatriots, Colin Rogers, a former member of the famed SAS assault team who, in Operation Nimrod back in 1980, tapped gently on the windows of the Iranian embassy in London, echoes his old mate's sentiments. Taking out a terrorist in the dust and the fire and the rubble that comprised the usual architectural legacy of covert explosive entry is not something that Special Forces soldiers tend to deliberate over too much, especially when you've got a state-of-the-art Heckler & Koch MP5 submachine gun slung over your shoulder, which fires 800 rounds a minute, and when the margin of error is often on the order of millimeters. Get a clear shot and you go for it. You focus. Stay calm, and coolly squeeze the trigger. Hesitation is not an option. The trick, it would appear, is being fireproof. It's being able to perform not just in the heat of the moment, but simply in the moment. It's about not feeling hot in the first place.
You're pumped up. Of course you are, Colin tells me, in his East End local pub that's clearly seen better days. But this is something you've been training for years. 6-7 hours a day. It's like driving. No journey is exactly the same, but you can cope pretty well with most eventualities. Your reactions become automatic. You use your judgment, yes, but even that's a product of the training. It's difficult to describe if you haven't actually been there. It's as if you've got a heightened sense of awareness of everything that's going on around you, like the opposite of being sloshed. But at the same time, you're also sort of outside the situation, like you're watching it on film. He's right, and not just when it comes to storming embassies. Recall the words of the neurosurgeon in the previous chapter? An intoxication that sharpens rather than dulls the senses is how he described it. The mindset he enters before taking on a difficult operation. In fact, in any kind of crisis, the most effective individuals are often those who stay calm, who are able to respond to the exigencies of the moment while at the same time maintaining the requisite degree of detachment. Consider the following, for example, an extract from an interview I did with a U.S. Special Forces instructor about the caliber of soldier that eventually, after one of the most grueling physical and psychological selection procedures in the world, makes it into the Navy SEALs, the guys who took out bin Laden. We did everything we could to break this guy. In fact, to be honest, we worked a bit harder on him than on the others. It got to be a bit of a challenge with us. Plus, we sort of knew, deep down, he could take it. He was orphaned at 11, but slipped through the net, looking after his younger brother and sister by living on his wits, stealing, wheeling, dealing, you know, that kind of thing. Then, when he was 16, he beat someone up so bad they went into a coma, and he got taken in. White noise, sleep deprivation, sensory deprivation, water, stress positions, the lot. We threw everything at him. Finally, after 48 hours, I removed the blindfold, put my face within a few centimeters of his, and yelled, "Is there anything you want to tell me?" To my surprise, and I've got to say disappointment, like I said, this guy was as hard as nails, and by this stage, we were actually willing him to pass. He said yes. There was something he wanted to say. "What is it?" I asked. "You want to cut down the garlic, dude?" he said. It was the only time in 15 years as an instructor that I let my guard slip. Just for a second, a split second, I smiled. I couldn't help it. I actually admired this guy. And you know what? Even in the disgusting, fucked-up state he was in, the son of a bitch saw it. He saw it. He called me back closer to him, and there was a look of sheer, I don't know, defiance. Who knows what it was, in his eyes. "Game over," he whispered in my ear. "You failed." What? I was meant to be saying that to him. It was then that we realized he was one of what we call the unbreakables, the toughest of the tough. But he was a ruthless fucking bastard, and if he did have a conscience, I never saw it. He was cold as ice, at either end of a weapon, which, actually, in this line of work, isn't always a bad thing. McNabb in the lab. True to his word, Andy rocks up to the Center for Brain Science at the University of Essex one bitterly cold December morning, and we're met at the door by the man who, for the next couple of hours or so, is going to be our tormentor. Dr. Nick Cooper is one of the world's leading exponents of TMS, and from the look of him this morning, you could be forgiven for thinking he's done most of the work on himself. Nick ushers us into the lab. The first things we notice are two high-backed leather chairs side by side, and next to them, the world's biggest roll of industrial paper toweling. I know what the toweling is for. It's to mop up the excess conductance gel that helps the EEG electrodes, which Nick is going to attach in a minute, pick up the signals from deep within our brains. Andy, on the other hand, has just his imagination to go on. "Christ," he says, pointing at the stack. "If that's the size of the toilet paper, then I'm out of here." Nick shows us over to the chairs and straps us in. He wires us up to heart rate monitors, EEG recording equipment, and galvanic skin response, GSR, measures, which assess stress levels as a function of electrodermal activity. By the time he's finished, the pair of us look like we're trapped inside a giant telecom junction box. The gel for the electrodes feels cold against my scalp. But Andy isn't complaining. He's finally figured out what the king-size TP roll is for. Directly in front of us, about 10 feet away on the wall, is a massive video screen. Nick flips a switch, which makes it crackle into life. Then he goes into white coat mode. Ambient music wafts around the room. A silky twilight lake ripples in front of our eyes. "Bloody hell," says Andy. "It's like an ad for incontinence pads." "Okay," says Nick. "Listen up. Right now on the screen in front of you, you can see a tranquil, restful scene which is presently being accompanied by quiet, relaxing music. This is to establish baseline physiological readings from which we can measure subsequent arousal levels. But at an undisclosed moment, sometime within the next 60 seconds, the image you see at the present time will change, and images of a different nature will appear on the screen. These images will be violent and nauseating, and of a graphic and disturbing nature. As you view these images, changes in your heart rate, skin conductance, and EEG activity will be monitored and compared with the resting levels that are currently being recorded. Any questions? Andy and I shake our heads. Happy? We nod. Okay, says Nick. Let's get the show on the road. He disappears behind us, leaving Andy and I to merrily soak up the incontinence ad. Results reveal later that, at this point, as we wait for something to happen, our physiological output readings are actually pretty similar. Both my and Andy's pulse rates are significantly higher than our normal resting levels in anticipation of what's to come. But when Nick pulls the lever, or whatever it is that initiates the change of scene, an override switch flips somewhere in Andy's brain. The ice-cold SAS soldier suddenly swings into action. As vivid, florid images of dismemberment, mutilation, torture, and execution flash up on the screen in front of us, so vivid, in fact, that Andy later confesses to actually being able to smell the blood, a kind of sickly sweet smell that you never, ever forget, accompanied not by the ambient spa music of before, but by blaring sirens and hissing white noise, his physiological readings start slipping into reverse. His pulse rate begins to slow, his GSR begins to drop, and his EEG to dramatically attenuate. In fact, by the time the show is over, all three of Andy's physiological output measures are pooling below his baseline. Nick has seen nothing like it. "It's almost as if he was gearing himself up for the challenge," he says. And then, when the challenge eventually presented itself, his brain suddenly responded by injecting liquid nitrogen into his veins, suddenly implemented a blanket neural cull of all surplus feral emotion, suddenly locked down into a hypnotically deep code red of extreme and ruthless focus. He shakes his head, nonplussed. "If I hadn't recorded those readings myself, I'm not sure I would have believed them," he continues. "Okay, I've never tested special forces before, and maybe you'd expect a slight attenuation in response, but this guy was in total and utter control of the situation. So tuned in, it looked like he'd completely tuned out." Just as Robert Hare had found, the data was so freakish, you really had to wonder who it came from. Back at the ranch, and the news, needless to say, isn't nearly as cool. My physiological output readings have gone through the roof. Exactly like Andy's, they'd weighed in well above baseline as I waited for the carnage to commence, but that's where the similarity had ended. Rather than go down in the heat of battle, in the midst of the blood and guts, mine had appreciated exponentially. "At least it shows that the equipment is working properly," comments Nick, "and that you're a normal human being." We look across at Andy, who's chatting up a bunch of Nick's PhD students over a bank of monitors. God knows what they make of him. They've just analyzed his data, and the electrode gel has done such a number on his hair he looks like Don King in a wind tunnel. I, on the other hand, am still getting over the shock of some of the images. I feel sick and jittery, and a little unsteady on my feet. I might, as Nick had pointed out, have shown up on the radar screens as normal. The needles and dials may well have vouched for my sanity, but I certainly don't feel normal as I cower in the corner of a cubicle, poring over the data on a computer screen. The difference in profiles is embarrassing. Whereas my EEG reading is a fair approximation of the New York skyline, a histographical cityscape of sheer, sharp, mathematical loft apartments, Andy's is like a top-end, low-rise golfing resort on one of those beautifully manicured islands in the middle of the Indian Ocean. Uniform and compact and insanely, uncannily symmetrical. Does make you wonder, doesn't it? I turn to Nick. What normal really is. He shrugs and resets the computer. Maybe you're about to find out, he says. Make me a psychopath. All done, Andy is off to a luxury hotel in the countryside, where I'll be joining him later for a debrief. But that's only after I've run the gauntlet again. In phase two of the experiment, with the aid of a psychopath makeover, I'll have another crack of the whip, another bash at the mayhem, carnage, and gore. Only this time, quite literally, with a completely different head-on, thanks to the same kind of treatment that Ahmed Karim and Leanne Young dished out in their moral processing experiments, a dose of TMS. The makeover does wear off, doesn't it? Andy laughs. 'Cause the hotel won't want two psychos propping up the bar. The effects of the treatment should wear off within half an hour, Nick elucidates, steering me over to a specially calibrated dentist's chair, complete with headrest, chin rest, and face straps. Think of TMS as an electromagnetic comb, and brain cells, neurons, as hairs. All TMS does is comb those hairs in a particular direction, creating a temporary neural hairstyle, which, like any new hairstyle, if you don't maintain it, quickly goes back to normal of its own accord. Andy's face is a picture. What the hell is this, a lab or a salon? Nick sits me down in the sinister-looking chair and pats me, a little too reassuringly for my liking, on the shoulder. By the time he's finished strapping and bolting me in, I look like Hannibal Lecter at LensCrafters. He positions the TMS coils, which resemble the handle part of a giant pair of scissors, over the middle section of my skull, and turns on the machine. Instantly, it feels as if there's a geeky homunculus miner buried deep inside my head, tapping away with a rock hammer. I wouldn't say it was painful, but you wouldn't want him to be just at the start of his shift. That's the electromagnetic induction passing down your trigeminal nerve, Nick explains. It's one of the nerves responsible for sensation in the face, and for certain motor functions like biting, chewing, and swallowing. You can probably feel it going through your back teeth, right? Right, I nod. What I'm actually trying to find, he continues, is the specific part of your motor cortex responsible for the movement of the little finger of your right hand. Once we've pinpointed that, I can use it as a kind of base camp, if you like, from which to plot the coordinates of the brain regions we're really interested in, your amygdala and your moral reasoning area. Well, you'd better get on with it, I mutter, because much more of this and I'm going to end up strangling you. Nick smiles. Blimey, he says. It must be working already. Sure enough, after about 20 seconds, I feel an involuntary twitch exactly where Nick has predicted. Weak at first, then gradually getting stronger. Pretty soon, my right pinky is really ripping it up. It's not the most comfortable feeling in the world, sitting strapped in a chair in a dimly lit chamber, knowing that you don't have any control over the actions your body is performing. It's creepy, demeaning, disorienting, and kind of puts a downer on the whole free will thing just a tad. My only hope is that Nick isn't in the mood to clown around. With the piece of gear he's waving about, he could have me doing cartwheels around the lab. Okay, he says. We now know the location of the areas we need to target. So, let's get started. My little finger stops moving as he repositions his spooky neurological wand in the force field above my head. It's then just a matter of sitting there for a while as my dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and right temporoparietal junction get an electromagnetic comb over. TMS can't penetrate far enough into the brain to reach the emotion and moral reasoning precincts directly, but by dampening down or turning up the regions of the cerebral cortex that have links with such areas, it can stimulate the effects of deeper, more incursive influence. It isn't long before I start to notice a more pronounced, more pervasive difference. Prior to the experiment, I'd been curious about the timescale, how long it would take me to begin to feel the rush. Now I had the answer, about 10 to 15 minutes. The same amount of time, I guess, that it would take most people to get a buzz out of a beer or a glass of wine. The effects aren't entirely dissimilar. An easy, airy confidence, a transcendental loosening of inhibition, the inchoate stirrings of a subjective moral swagger, the encroaching and somehow strangely spiritual realization that, hell, who gives a shit anyway? There is, however, one notable exception, one glaring, unmistakable difference between this and the effects of alcohol, the lack of attendant sluggishness. The perseveration, in fact, I'd even say enhancement, of attentional acuity and sharpness. An insufferable feeling of heightened, polished awareness. Sure, my conscience certainly feels like it's been spiked with moral Rohypnol. My anxieties, drowned with a half dozen shots of transcranial magnetic Jack Daniels. But at the same time, my whole way of being feels like it's been sumptuously spring-cleaned with light. My soul, or whatever you want to call it, immersed in a spiritual dishwasher. So this, I think to myself, is how it feels to be a psychopath. To see through Gary Gilmore's eyes. To cruise through life knowing that no matter what you say or do, guilt, remorse, shame, pity, fear, all of those familiar everyday warning signals that might normally light up your psychological dashboard no longer trouble you. I suddenly get a flash of insight. We talk about gender, we talk about class, we talk about color and intelligence and creed. But the most fundamental difference between one individual and another must surely be the presence or absence of conscience. Conscience is what hurts when everything else feels good. But what if it's as tough as old boots? What if one's conscience has an infinite, unlimited pain threshold and doesn't bat an eye when others are screaming in agony? Even more importantly, will my prosthetic psychopath implants make me cooler than Andy McNabb? Back in the chair, wired up to the counters and bleepers, I sit through the horror show again. The image is modified so as to avoid habituation. This time, however, it's a completely different story. I know the guy before me found these images nauseating, I hear myself saying. But actually, to be honest, this time round I'm finding it hard to suppress a smile. The lines and squiggles corroborate my confession. Whereas previously, such was my level of arousal that it was pretty much a minor miracle that the state-of-the-art EEG printer didn't blow up and burst into flames, my brain activity after the psychopath makeover is significantly reduced. Perhaps not quite as genteelly undulating as Andy's, but getting there, certainly. Not a New York skyscraper in sight. It's a similar story when it comes to heart rate and skin conductance. In fact, in the case of the latter, I actually eclipse Andy's reading. Does that mean it's official? I ask Nick as we scrutinize the figures. Can I legitimately claim to be cooler than Andy McNabb? He shrugs. I suppose, he says. For now, anyway. But you better make the most of it while you can. You've got a quarter of an hour, max. I shake my head. Already I sense the magic wearing off. the electromagnetic sorcery starting to wane. I feel, for instance, considerably more married than I did a bit earlier, and considerably less inclined to go up to Nick's research assistant and ask her out for a drink. Instead, I go with Nick to the student bar and beat my previous best on Gran Turismo out of sight. I floor it all the way round. But so what? It's just a game, isn't it? I wouldn't want to be with you in a real car at the moment, says Nick. You're definitely still a bit ballsy. It feels great. Not quite as good as before, perhaps, when we were in the lab. Not quite as, I don't know, impregnable. But up there, for sure. Life seems full of possibility. My psychological horizon's much broader. Why shouldn't I piss off to Glasgow this weekend for my buddy's stag party, instead of dragging myself over to Dublin to help my wife put her mother in a nursing home? Why not just do the opposite of what I normally would? And to hell with what people think. I mean, what's the worst that can happen? This time next year, this time next week even, it would all be forgotten. Who dares wins, right? I take a couple of quid from the table next to ours, left as a tip, but who's going to know, and try my luck on another couple of machines. I get to $100,000 on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, but crash and burn because I refuse to go 50-50. You couldn't have staged it better if you tried. I'm positive American Psycho is set in L.A. and nonchalantly pushed the button despite Nick's reservations. It's New York. I thought you'd at least get that one, he laughs. Then things start to change, quite quickly as it happens. Gran Turismo the second time around is a disappointment. I'm suddenly more cautious and finish way down the field. Not only that, I notice the security camera in the corner and think about the tip I've just pocketed. To be on the safe side, I decide to pay it back. Nick looks at his watch. I know it's coming. He doesn't need to tell me. Still cooler than McNabb? I smile and swig my beer. But that's the way it is with psychopaths. They never stick around for long. As soon as the party's over, they're moving on to the next one, with scant regard for the future, and even less for the past. And this one, the one, I guess, that was me for 20 minutes, was no exception. He'd had his fun, and got a free drink out of it. But now that the experiment was history, he was on his way, hitting the road and heading out of town. Hopefully, quite some distance. I certainly didn't want him showing up in the hotel bar later, where I was meeting Andy. They'd either get on great or wouldn't get on at all. To be perfectly honest, I didn't know which was scarier.
Context of white supremacy. That will wrap this session of the audio for The Wisdom of Psychopaths. We'll pick up next week on Chapter 6, The Seven Deadly Wins. Took a lot of notes, so we will get right to it. The number 641-715-3640 and the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. I took a lot of notes, so I suspect others could have also found this to be a fascinating portion of reading. So we'll see if everybody can take 6 minutes, including Gus T. Everybody can take 6 minutes. That way we'll have time in case there are any additional comments, questions people want to get in. Please don't wait till the last minute. Everyone who dialed in with a hand up should be with us. Roz, Mr. Demery for Mel. I'll look for other folks as well. Everybody gets 6 minutes. Feel free.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'd like to comment on a couple of things. Gary Gilmore, first of all, I think he did his two murders in 76, and then he asked to be executed in 77. You know, according to the reading, that seemed like the point he was trying to make, that he did something, I guess, out of the ordinary when he asked to be executed. But, you know, if you look at it from another way, if they let him sit on death row for about 10 years, not knowing when his execution will be, just let him suffer out, you know, those days, it'd probably be more fitting for his crime. So actually, he was taking the smart way out, asking for an early execution. I think Della Roof did the same thing. So, you know, if you give in to these individuals, then they're manipulating the situation even after they're caught. And I noticed a lot of references to genitals, urine, you know, grabbing people from behind when he's, you know, skydiving. You know, talking about the size of somebody's genitals. You know, that seems to be a pattern with these psychopaths and whites in general. You know, and he glorifies people in the military, special forces, SAS. It's just like Roz was saying, I believe that a lot of this is, you know, related to military-mindedness and looking at things from a warlike standpoint. And then it just dawns on you when it says to see through Gary Gilmore's eyes, to cruise through life, knowing that no matter what you say, guilty, more shame, pity, fear.
Your volume dropped, Mr. Demrefour. Your volume dropped really low.
Oh, okay. I'm just reading a part about Gary Gilmore. And, you know, to be absent of all these emotions, what I say finally is, you know, to actually be a shell of a human. You wouldn't, like Roz was saying, you wouldn't qualify as a human being. And the last thing, talking about the fundamental differences between one individual and another, must surely be the presence or absence of conscience. Conscience is what hurts when everything else feels good. I think that, you know, I think that color trumps, racism trumps it all. And that's just the bottom line on that. So I'll mute my line for somebody else to start you.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demrefour. Other folks have commentary they wanted to get in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, one thing that I found, especially after reading this section and what you talked about previously about him taking all of this expensive equipment and surveying 3 million people, to me, his psychopathy shows up in his fascination with psychopathy. All of this that he's putting into it, just to me, is so indicative of his psychopathy. He may not function exactly identical to other psychopaths, but he's no less the white psychopath either. Page 143, he says, it was 8 in the morning when the firing squad picked up their rifles before, as is tradition, pulling a black corduroy hood over his head. The warden, as is also tradition, asked Gilmore if there were any last words. Gilmore stared straight ahead, his eyes colder than the great whites, as the inaudible thunder of death rumbled across his soul. Now, this ties into what Mr. Demery just talked about. I thought the same thing, that he was taking his destiny in his own hands, not allowing the system to get its satisfaction of stringing him along and toying with his lack of emotions by making him wonder about, like Mr. Demery said, when his last days would be. But what I find fascinating is the fact that white people are so used to using these metaphors, and the inaccuracy of what they talk about is just legendary. And where he is inaccurate is when he says this statement, his eyes were colder than the great whites. Great white sharks are warm-blooded sharks. I know it because I've been studying animals since I was a little boy. And you can look it up yourself. That's one of the reasons they can function in the most cold of temperatures and fling themselves out of the water, sometimes 20 feet in the air, to kill a seal. So right there, he's lying like white people do. and great whites are not cold-blooded. They're one of the few sharks that are not. On page 144, he writes, now, one of the things that we know about psychopaths is that the light switches of their brains aren't wired up quite the same as ours, and that the one area particularly affected, the amygdala, a peanut-sized structure located right at the very center of the circuit board, the amygdala, as we have learned previously in this book, the brain's emotion control tower. It polices our emotional airspace and is responsible for the way we feel about things. In psychopaths, a section of this airspace, the part corresponding to fear, is empty. Now, again, to me, he's trying to normalize himself because he said that their brains aren't wired up the same as the rest of ours, including himself. In the so-called normal group, nothing about him is normal, and I think this book elucidates the mental illness that is to be white, the psychopathic mental illness that it is, to, as far as what it means to be white. On page 156, he writes, "It isn't long before I start to notice a fuzzier, more pervasive, a more existential, difference." Prior to the experiment, I've been curious about the time scale, how long it would take me to begin to feel the rush. Now I had the answer, about 10 to 15 minutes, the same amount of time I guess that it would take for most people to get a buzz out of a beer or glass of wine. The effects aren't entirely dissimilar. An easy, airy confidence and transcendental loosening of inhibition, the inchoate stirrings of a subjective moral swagger, the encroaching and somehow strangely spiritual realization that, hell, who gives a shit anyway? There is, however, one notable exception, one glaring, unmistakable difference between this and the effects of alcohol, the lack of attendant sluggishness, the perseveration, in fact, I'd like to say enhancement of attentional acuity and sharpness, an insuperable feeling of heightened, polished awareness. Sure, my conscience certainly feels like it's been spiked with moral rehypnol. My anxieties drowned with half a dozen shots of transcranial magnetic Jack Daniel, but at the same time, the whole way of being feels like it's sumptuously spring cleaned with light. My soul, or whatever you want to call it, immersed in a spiritual dishwasher. This speaks to the amygdala, again, being the center of where dopamine comes from. This, he's describing the high of what it means to be a white supremacist psychopath. To me, it also, the way that he wrote this, tries to make it seem like there's a difference between some white people, because they don't express their psychopathy the way that he's measuring it, and then the people who go through this sort of transformation, like Andy or the Mr. Gilmore, Gary Gilmore. So again, he's playing mind games as white supremacists do, but he's showing right here that there is a high that they get from the abuse and murder and genocide they commit against black people. I will mute my line. I know I hit my 6 minutes. Hopefully I'll get to chime in a little bit more later. Thank you.
Indeed. Appreciate that, Roz. Mel, did you have commentary? You should be with us as well.
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
So in this section, I think it starts off with him telling like the story of a very, I guess, callous and kind of cold, uncaring soldier, I think, a man in some sort of special forces. And I found that section really interesting. I'm again reminded, maybe like last week when I was mentioning the CTE thing, I guess the making of psychopaths, specifically the usage of drugs with soldiers in Vietnam and the usage of Agent Orange testing that on black male soldiers here in the United States, and how that causes mental issues, and how that seems to be even today. There's a documentary, I can't remember the name of it, that talks about soldiers currently in Iraq, Iran, and I guess what would be called Middle Eastern conflicts, still on drugs. And I guess how that's, I think it's just messing up any cognitive, moral barriers that they have both abroad and when they come back home and are walking among us. And I'm just reminded that there are many of these so-called psychopaths in law enforcement and military. And actually in law enforcement, I remembered my point about the lawyers from earlier. And I was thinking like, well, not all lawyers are bad. But there's a lot of psychopaths in like the law field, and lawyers are an extension of law enforcement. I think in the code, in the compensatory code, I think if they're practicing and enforcing the laws of white supremacy, they're technically outlaws, but there are a lot of them out there. So it's still important to be cautious of, you know, any form of law enforcement, military, as well as, I guess, so-called lawyers. And on that note, I guess I'm thinking if we're talking about a brain imbalance, because it seemed like there was a lot of focus on brain activity, so-called wave sections of the brain that light up in this section. And it seems like there's been a lot of testing that he's been doing in the book or that other people have been doing that he's been quoting. And I'm just thinking if we're talking about a brain imbalance, to some extent, I wonder if we're talking about a disability. And disability to me would necessitate accommodation. And when it's a potential danger to others, I think it necessitates an intentional, deliberate observation of those individuals. Like, according to him, people are just testing positive, it seems like, for psychopathy or psychopathic symptoms or activity in their mind. And I'm curious if he at any point would advocate what should be done with or to people who are so-called proven psychopaths. And then I guess my last point would be that I noticed that the book has so far involved it's mostly made me seem like it's involved a lot of a few murderers, a lot of soldiers, a lot of CEOs, a lot of surgeons. And I just want to underscore that these brutal psychopathic people are not exceptional to, I guess, fields of power or fame or prominence that they pretty much walk among us. They are at Target. They are at the bank taking your checks. They are, you know, helping your kids cross the street. I mean, I think I just in light of all the examples he's been using, I was thinking about that. And of course, some recent incidents I've had. So that was it.
Ashe, absolutely. They are your school teachers, white women, your school teachers. See if I can do 6 minutes as well. Some of the notes that I took, I was just speaking with a Cows listener about the death penalty, and I told them that in Utah, they have the death penalty, and it's by firing squad. That's the Mormons, and then they mentioned that in the text. There's been a lot of reference to alcohol consumption in the book. It seems Mr. Dutton is meeting with different colleagues, and either they're drinking coffee, caffeinated drinks, or booze. Whites, alcohol, dangerous combination. Let's see. I thought it was interesting that this whole, what he calls psychopath makeover, so that you could get the experience of being a psychopath and being less inhibited and reckless and daring and all the rest of it and not, you know, fearful. It's not make me a more moral person so that I can better empathize with other people. It's the opposite direction. That is the interests of racist man, racist woman, racist child. It is not about the promotion of justice. That's why I said in my view, the whole book, it has been about the glorification of white culture and violence, killing. That's what it's been about, in glorifying psychopaths, even though he says early on that it's not. I just don't believe him. Continuing where he says, one of the, I guess, main tasks of the Special Forces Group, Bravo 20, one of their tasks, primary tasks, was gathering intelligence. One of the things that whites dedicate a lot of time and energy to. Moving forward, this whole conversation around this book that was published by this British soldier, Andy McNabb, it reminded me so much of Chris Kyle, the white soldier, Navy SEAL, who was shot and killed once he was back here as a civilian. We read his book, American Sniper, and there were a lot of allegations that he fabricated, that he made up a lot of the things that he was talking about. But this Andy McNabb guy reminds me of Chris Kyle so much. I guess folks that were with us who read American Sniper, they can, you know, reflect, see if that's an accurate comparison. Him writing this book and talking about this whole gruesome ordeal, and you just go out and do it, the shooting, everything, the urine references, it was Chris Kyle American Sniper all over. When he says slagging everyone else off, taking the piss, I think Mr. Demery Ford mentioned that. Dr. Welsing, for sure. Phallic symbols, lots of reference to the genital area. white genetic annihilation, I think, constantly being in the forefront of the racist mind, and then different ways of using the genitals as a weapon and focusing attention there. I think that's the urine and all that is about. Reminded me of Delectable Negro as well. Continuing. Man, put it this way, if you've got a problem with the size of your dick, an Iraqi interrogation suit probably isn't the best place to find out. Wow. Welsing moment. Theater of War was actually said again in this portion of the text. Roz mentioned that, how it's just entertains always violence, whether we're going to the movies or everything is viewed as violence, and violence as a form of entertainment and amusement. Like we're going to watch a movie. Yes, we're going out to kill lots of people. Let's see next. And the same thing, they refer to it as a ball game. These exercises of warfare, that phrase is used later on. Let's see. The homoeroticism, I think Mr. Demery Ford noted that as well. The use of the term fuck it. I mentioned Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told. I referenced that after the first audio segment. He has a whole chapter 7. It's called titled The Seed. And it begins, he says, fuck, from Old English word meaning to strike, to beat. Before that, in an even older language, to plow, to tear open. And he goes with the connotations of the seed and what it means to fuck. He continues, this tree turned into a bush, in short, is fucked. So too is the soil. When the enslaved men broke it open for the entrepreneur, he fucked this dirt with them as his tool. He fucked the field. He might fuck their wives out in the woods or in the corn when it is high, or their daughter in the kitchen. Then the next new girl he buys at New Orleans. But he fucks the men too. He plants in all his hands the seeds of his dreams. In fact, he plants them, all men and women, in this place, just as he plants as those seeds. Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told, reminded me just to have it stated explicitly when I hear that term, and in this context of it's a lot of sexual references, a lot of violence. It reminded me immediately of that portion of Edward Baptist and Dr. Welsing as well. Also, let's see, when they were giving this laundry list of torture techniques, just direct physical violence was not included. That was very suspicious to me. And out and out sexual exploitation not being included, since, you know, there's been so much of that already. They didn't urinate on this person. Even when they kept saying, when he's talking about these different experiments and they're going to put the wires on and the electrodes, and they keep saying, strap us in. It's said multiple times, strap us in, and strapping and bolting me in. It just had a very sexual feel to it, sexualized feel to the way that sounded. And in the context of the reading, unless that's just me. He used the phrase white coat mode. I know what it meant. I just have never heard that before. I think I'm going to borrow that from now on, because I think racists, they do a lot of damage when they are in white coat mode. Let's see, when they kept talking about the images that they put on the screen to do this test to see how they would respond to all this violence and what have you, and it said the images will be violent and nauseating and a graphic and disturbing nature, as vivid, florid images of dismemberment, mutilation, torture, and execution flash upon the screen in front of us. I was thinking, were they watching The Walking Dead? As I said before, there's so much of this content, you don't necessarily have to have, you don't necessarily have to go and commit violence yourself now, because it's so ubiquitous in the culture. You can just turn on The Walking Dead or just go on social media and see the latest enforcement officer that has gunned down a black person, the latest dash cam footage or what have you. They just had the cop Michael Slager that was convicted this week. I'm sure they got footage of Walter Scott's execution being played out. You can see all kinds of violence at will, real time. The reference to Don King, I just have to say, I think that's an act of racism on his part, because there have been Really, no black people mentioned in this text at all, unless I have been in error. The only black person I think was mentioned was Tiger Woods, and I guess you can put that in quotes, Cowbell as well, but was Tiger Woods. I can't think of any other black people that have been mentioned in the text thus far. You know, if anybody can think of someone, remember, but even if you can, there's been such a dearth of black people mentioned in the book. Yeah, President Obama's not even mentioned. There's been such a lack of black people mentioned to have Don King thrown in as this joke that Andy's hair looks so wild and uncouth that it looked like Don King, and not just Don King, but Don King in a wind tunnel. I will say that I think that's an act of conscious, deliberate white supremacy on the part of Mr. Dutton. Also, the phrase after he gets his psychopath makeover, he says he wants another crack of the whip. Racist metaphor, I think. Whites hankering for an opportunity to lash someone. I can't think of what else you would be doing with a crack of the whip. What else would you be doing but lashing someone? Whites have done a lot of that with black people, or lashing an animal of some sort. But that just, to me, that just seems like a metaphor of white supremacy. Last one I'll get in, I think I'll be at my 6 minutes or close to. I think to myself, is how it feels to be a psychopath, to see through Gary Gilmore's eyes. Again, just wanting to literally have the experience. This is what it feels like to be a killer. And not just a killer, but I can kill someone and just go hang out with my girlfriend and not feel any sort of conscience or guilt about it at all. Oh, this is like that. I think just as Roz said, to even write something that way. And that's the whole title of the chapter. Like, wow. I mean, if that right there, the essence of psychopathy, to want that sort of perspective. We're not thinking about, I want the perspective of someone pursuing justice. I want to see the world as someone who is doing everything that they can to produce justice. No, I want the perspective of a killer. That is white culture. Did other folks have commentary they wanted to get in? We have about 6 minutes left.
Yes, I did. I think there was like two things I wanted to bring up. And great insights, Gus, as well. This was on page 136. He writes, more worrying still, according to Gene Twing, a professor of psychology at San Diego State University, is that during the same period, student self-reported narcissism levels, in contrast, have gone in the other direction. They've shot through the roof. Many people see the current group of college students, sometimes called Generation Me, Conrath continues, quote, as one of the most self-centered, narcissistic, competitive, confident, and individualistic in recent history. Hardly, surprising than that the former head of the British Armed Forces, Lord Donnet, had recently championed the notion that recruits undergo a moral education as part of their basic training, so lacking are many in a basic core value system. People have had the same exposure to traditional values. People haven't had the same exposure to traditional values which previous generations had than it articulates. So we feel it's important people have a moral baseline. Throw them in the army, they used to say, of delinquents. Not anymore. They've got enough of them already. Now, what I find interesting is these people are already morally bankrupt. That is why England has owned more land than any other country in history, was due to its white supremacist behavior throughout history. And he's trying to make it seem like their people, because if the people he's talking about are white, the majority of people in England today are white, more than non-white, from what I know. So he's basically speaking about his own people, and he's playing a semantical game of jargon nonsense, trying to give the impression that older generations of white British people had any morals to begin with. And the other thing I wanted to talk about was, yes, it's on page 139. He writes, Richardson had other ideas. Is it true, he asked Burnett, that the accused possesses a variation of a gene that codes for low levels of MAOA? Yes, replied Burnett. Is it also true, continued Richardson, that he was violently and repeatedly beaten by his parents as a child? Yes, repeated Burnett. then to what extent is the man that stands before you now completely responsible for his actions, persisted Richardson? To what extent has I'm sorry. Thank you. I'm sorry. To what extent has his free will been eroded by his genetic predisposition? It was a groundbreaking question, particularly for Bradley Waldrop, whose very existence depending on the outcome hung precariously in the balance. It got an equally groundbreaking answer, and so on and so forth. We know what happened here. Now, what I find very interesting is that they make all of these medical provisions when white people do what they normally do. His psychopathic behavior is normal throughout white history. They've been doing the most heinous things to each other before they met us and other non-white people to do it to us. So again, it's a way of scientifically normalizing or using it or displaying some sort of abnormality in order to facilitate giving us empathy towards these psychopaths. And then in other instances, they try to normalize it because you have people like Donald Trump. And he, again, like you said throughout this evening, this book is about the worship of psychopaths. We're reading it every time we start a new chapter. That's exactly what he's doing. And, you know, they're going to always make excuses for themselves or find ways, even when they're supposedly trying to dispense justice, they're going to find a way to get you to empathize with the outlaw. That's because white culture is outlaw culture. It's criminal culture. And white supremacy is the apex of that criminal culture. Thank you.
Indeed. Chapter 4 is The Wisdom of Psychopaths. I'm just self-correcting. Yes, Mel, we can hear you.
I'm sorry about that. I just wanted to touch on the Don King thing. I agree with that. I thought it was a strange reference too. I'm thinking like about even Donald Trump mentioning like the bats LeVar Ball, like, oh, you think you're Don King. That's a thing that happened with his son in China. I'm just kind of curious if there's like an obsession going on, because when you think about it, back in that, I guess in the time period when this book is being written, Shaun White is like a famous white snowboarder. He has a large red afro. Ross is like a famous white painter. He has a huge like brown afro. I mean, he's been in the, I think he was a veteran himself. And then I'm thinking, Phil Spector has like a huge blonde afro, and he was mentioned in the book. And you could have like mentioned anyone with an afro and just randomly bringing up Don King. That was it. Oh, I did agree with Mr. Demery Ford and your estimations about what he was, or your statements about what he was, just kind of the accumulation of statements about, I guess, sort of homosexual humor, or sort of just bring up very strangely erotic, unnecessarily erotic examples and terminology throughout the book. It's been a lot of sexual talk lately.
Absolutely. Even that point about diva dominatrix, that was the term for the host of that game show that I've never seen. That's why I don't have a reference, but he called her a diva dominatrix. Dominatrix is also very sexualized. That's a whole, you know, BDS, you know, fetish thing, but lots of sexual terms throughout the duration of the text. We will leave it there for the week. We will finish up. I think we have two sessions left and we'll be all done. Two sessions and two chapters. It might be that we do one chapter per week. But we'll be at next Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be here tomorrow for the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll catch up on what's gone down over the past 7 days. Folks have counter-racist suggestions they would like to share. Thanks for everyone who tuned in. I hope it's been a constructive investment of your Friday evening. Hopefully the book has been worthy of the read. I would again like to recommend Sobriety. I know it's the weekend. Folks might have plans, visiting, holidays, and all of that. God forbid if you have an office party to attend. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. If there are white psychopaths, and particularly if you have a lot of white psychopaths with badges, you certainly do not want to be out and about intoxicated when you cannot make quality decisions to keep yourself safe, you and anybody you might be responsible for. I think Dr. Welsing, Mr. Fuller, Dr. Cambon, Mr. Amos Wilson, lots of the folks that we revere, I think they also would co-sign on, yes, it would behoove us to do everything we can to preserve our mental
spiritual, emotional, physical health as best we can in a very toxic environment. Keep all of the poisons out of our system. If you're going to be behind the wheel, even if you're going to be a passenger, you should be sober and buckled up. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim. Man,
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.